Good morning. I'm Lindsay Volkman of the National Cancer Institute, and it is my honor and pleasure to welcome you all here today to Informatics in Action, sponsored by the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health. For those of you unaccustomed to the NIH security clearance process, congratulations, you made it through. And for those of you watching by videocast, congratulations, you avoided the guard dogs and the pat-downs. Today we have convened a seminal group of leaders in health from both the public and private sectors to discuss how consumer technologies are changing the face of healthcare delivery and personal health management. We are here to explore how both emerging evidence and current knowledge in the behavioral and social sciences have the potential to inform the direction, design, implementation, and ongoing adaptation of these evolving health IT applications. The behavioral sciences have contributed significantly in the efforts to improve population health. Continued research in this area offers the promise of health promotion advancements with even greater utility and efficiency in the years to come. To be effective, our science needs legs. It needs to move from bench to bedside to speed translation of promising research discoveries into routine and representative practice. Currently, we are faced with a challenge. We're faced with a challenge in the dissemination and translation of our research. It is therefore critical that we identify new delivery channels that may speed the translation of our science into both medical treatments and effective consumer tools. Today's leaders in IT, such as those represented on this morning's panel, offer new and unique channels and pathways that may increase the reach, scope, and effectiveness of our science. In essence, they offer the potential to give our research new legs. In a recent commentary on the evolution of health IT, a senior executive at a large health system spoke of the potential impact of technology heavyweights such as Google, Microsoft, and Intel. Quote, "Our world is set to be shaken, and we have to get ahead of this curve for the benefit of patient care." Today's speakers have been tasked with the following: to explain how these innovative health technologies have the potential to shake our world for the benefit of population health, and to address how publicly funded research and private IT may collaborate to advance our nation's health initiatives. To kick us off, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Bob Croyle, NCI's Division Director of the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences. Dr. Croyle?
Thanks, Lindsay. I just want to welcome all of you for coming out today on a rainy day for this symposium, and also put it a little bit in the context of a series of activities and initiatives that we at the NCI and others at the NIH have been engaging in the last few years in the area of trying to marry more strongly the areas of public health, prevention, behavioral science, and information technology in a domain that is often referred to as e-health. A few years ago at the NCI, under the leadership of Dr. Barbara Reimer, the NCI designated as one of its top research priorities the area of health communication and also technology related to the translation of IT developments into public health and prevention. And there were a few key efforts as a part of that effort. One was the launching of Centers of Excellence in Cancer Communication Research, four which were funded. And we're pleased to announce that we recently issued an RFA to continue that initiative of Centers of Excellence in Cancer Communication Research. And these were designed to bring together folks working in many different disciplines, information technology, public health, behavioral science, oncology, and communication science as broadly defined. And in addition, another important initiative that's carried on as well under the leadership of Dr. Brad Hesse, who I'll be introducing, is a national survey called the Health Information National Trend Survey, or HINTS. And this is a national survey that captures the public's knowledge and awareness about cancer, but also delves into their utilization of cancer information and assesses how the public seeks and responds to cancer information, whether it's over the internet or their other public channels. Now, one of the key elements of NCI's strategic plan over the last few years is the Cancer Bioinformatics Grid, a major effort led by Dr. Ken Buto, who's with us today. And the Cancer Bioinformatics Grid has come to kind of a critical transition point because if you go up on the NCI website and go to the CA Big link, you'll see a new report which describes the accomplishments of the 3-year pilot phase of the CA Big project. CA Big is now transitioning into a number of expanded areas, including a greater emphasis on the clinical context, particularly in the context of clinical trials, and also expanding from our NCI cancer centers that have been major partners of this effort into the new National Community Cancer Centers program, which Dr. Niederhuber launched during his directorship of the National Cancer Institute. Another theme behind this is the bridging of disciplines, and I know that among the many academicians who we fund to do research on e-health and e-health applications, oftentimes those academics don't have the opportunity to interact and hear insights from leaders in the private sector. So we felt it was important to bring together three very visible leaders from the private sector to the NIH community so that the biomedical research community can get a perspective from industry on where industry is thinking and going in terms of consumer health informatics. So where we're trying to complement the traditional areas of bioinformatics and more recently CA Big's efforts in biomedical informatics, what we hope to today is raise some of the issues and trends in terms of consumer health informatics and applications that are what we call consumer facing, that is the interface between the layperson and the internet, the web, and information technology. So it's my pleasure at this point to introduce our leader in terms of health communication and applied informatics, particularly as it relates to cancer prevention and control, Dr. Brad Hesse. Brad is the chief of our branch in health communication and informatics and also is the program lead on the Health Information National Trend Survey. Brad's going to kind of place this symposium in context and then introduce our three distinguished guest speakers. Brad.
Okay, whenever I get together with an audience like this, first people ask questions like, okay, what's a psychologist doing at NCI? And why is behavior somehow important to what we're doing to control cancer in the United States and abroad? So that's one question I have to answer. And then we say, okay, but now we're going to bring leaders from industry in information technology. So the new question arises, behavior, information technology, cancer control, how is this all coming together? What is the perfect storm you think is going on here? And that's what I want to share a little bit. But to do that, I'd like to be just a little bit provocative. We researchers tend to have memories like elephants. And I'm going to go back and recall an interview on a Charlie Rose show on August 29th, 2004. And one of the people that we had on that panel turned out was Andy Groves from Intel, CEO of Intel. And he was challenging the scientists of the day. So you'll recognize an NIH director, you'll recognize a previous NCI director, about what it is that we need to do and how can we accelerate progress toward cancer. And all this was around an article that had come out in Fortune magazine. So let me play that for you.
Cancer, perhaps within the next decade, is likely to replace heart disease as a leading cause of U.S. deaths. That is, according to forecasts by the NCI and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it is already the biggest killer of those under 75. We want to talk about that in the context of this article in Fortune magazine.
All right. You know what? That actually is a video, and you can actually see him move, lips speak. Let's try this one more time, just for fun.
Cancer, perhaps, within the next...
Okay, this isn't going to work. So technology, see why we have to have behaviorists here in the audience? Let's try this one more time, see if we can get it to work this time. It was great in rehearsal.
Cancer, perhaps...
Oh, he's a stoic guy, but that's all right. Just listen to him.
Heart disease is a leading cause of U.S. deaths.
Imagine
that is, according to forecasts by the NCI and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it is already the biggest killer of those under 75. We want to talk about that in the context of this article in Fortune magazine, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It, reported by Clifton Lee. Joining me now to talk about it, in addition, Harold Varmus. He is president and CEO of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, Dr. Andrew von Ischenbach, director of the National Cancer Institute, and two cancer survivors, Andy Grove, chairman of Intel, and Cliff Leap, who, as I said, is executive editor of Fortune magazine and the author of this article. Let me begin with him.
It's all a sort of red herring, if you will, because the key is not whether... you know, we can slowly progress in these drugs. The key is whether we can save lives now. And in fact, Katie Couric has done more to save lives from colon cancer than all of this stuff that we're talking about. by going on television and having a colonoscopy.
Except it's not right? either or.
No, it's not either or, but it's, I agree, but we have to shift our resources. And that's where we have to get serious about, I think, you know, making that judgment.
But do you think he's making an argument as either or?
You're not making distinctions between science and the practice of medicine. That's a very dangerous confusion. All scientists I know would say no one should die in this country of colon cancer. And the reason we don't have the instruments in place to ensure that's true, it's not a need for more science. We need public information. We need gastroenterologists who are willing to handle the scale of colonoscopy for everybody. We need every insurance company and the national treasury to cover colonoscopy for everyone over 50. This is a problem we can solve.
So this is a problem we can solve with current knowledge. We listen to that on Population Sciences, and it piques us up. We say, what can we do? How can we reduce as much burden as we have currently from cancer? Are there other ways of moving forward that we haven't thought of? How can we think out of the box? What I'd like to share with you here, and this does seem to be working, is just a view from cancer's perspective of what the etiology of the disease looks like laid over a full lifespan. So you can see there's this period up at the beginning of susceptibility. When cancer is not pre-initiated, there may be some genetic risk, but for the most part, environmental exposure plays a big role. That's a place where we can intervene. And if we can intervene up there, we can roll back a good part of the cancer burden. And in fact, most of the work that we've done, the successes we've seen over the past 10, 12 years in turning the war on cancer have come from some of these interventions. Early on, intervene during a period of susceptibility. Again, this is impressive when it shows the video.
You know what? We're going to leave this here for you so you can see what 1,200 people actually look like.
Some of you have seen this, I'm sure, on television. This is part of the Truth Campaign funded by the Legacy Foundation. It's an evidence-based behavioral research campaign that is now having an effect in turning adolescents from initiating smoking and getting them hip to the notion that they really need to think about smoking cessation. But there are a lot of behavioral challenges ahead of us. First off, we're seeing a bit of an asymptote in cessation. So we know we can do better. We can give more people the tools they need to stop smoking now and have an impact on that mortality. We also notice that the tobacco companies, to be honest, are using the new media technologies against us. So they're using the internet. They're using global markets. They've been exploiting exactly this thing that we in our laboratories sometimes tend to ignore. And we need to do something about that. Let's look at the second point of intervention. So even if we go beyond that period of susceptibility,
highlights, cancer is easiest to deal with in an early stage before tumors are aggregating.
This is Andy Gross, from CEO from Intel, talking about the next place where we can intervene, and this is by identifying cancer in its earliest stages. And if we can do something at that stage, if we can identify colorectal polyps, if we can identify through pap smears, pre-cervical lesions, those kinds of things, we can certainly go a long way in controlling cancer in the population. And that's the second biggest impact we've had over the past decade. But there are issues here as well. There are issues of awareness, there are issues of access, and there are psychological issues of action and motivation. As Katie Couric puts it, no one should be dying of embarrassment. But that's what we happen sometimes when we talk about such things as colorectal screening. We have to think about ways of making this available to people and let them take advantage of that. Even if it's the case that we progress to a point, tumors progress to a point where we can't remove them entirely, there is a lot of work being done at the NCI, and this is the vision of future to come, where we can control its behavior, where cancer can become a chronic disease. And if that's the case, then we can work to keep it under wraps so that we don't die of metastasis. So it's not tumors that kill us, it's metastasis, it's angiogenesis. Can we interfere in that process? We think that's very likely, but in a population-wide level, the behavioral issues are huge. I'm citing a study by David Baker here that just came out recently, about 2-3 months ago, in the Archives of Internal Medicine, where he talked about, he traced the geriatric population, and the people from Intel, I think, would find that interesting, and found that for those with severe literacy issues, those that could not understand directions on a pill bottle or instructions on what to do next, that severe literacy was associated with a 39% mortality in that population. So not knowing what to do next and not living in an environment that tells us what to do next is killing us. And that's something we have to address. All right, so how do we do that? I'm going to go jump across the pond for a minute, look in the United Kingdom. Here's Harry Caton, the National Director for Patients and the Public in the National Health Service. In that country, which has nationalized medicine, they're looking at huge costs hitting that system, and they're looking at a population that's growing older. Very similar, even though we don't have a nationalized health system here, very similar to what we're confronting. And he's looking around at other industries for analogies of what we need to do. This I borrowed from a talk he gave about a year and a half ago. This is a flat pack from IKEA. So those of you who have bought furniture at IKEA, it's a brilliant marketing ploy. It's a brilliant manufacturing move, because what it allows IKEA to do is to keep their inventory stocked up just in time for shipment to you so you can take it home and then you do assembly. We don't have to have warehouses filled up with lots of furniture. He said that in the UK, they envision a world in the future where patients are empowered and they become almost like flat pack patients. They know how to assemble their own healthcare with assistance and aid every step of the way. But by engaging the public, especially in chronic disease, we can extend life, we can work better at prevention, we can improve health status and quality of life, and in fact, by doing that, we will improve our use of resources. But to do this, he said, the use of information technology is key. The UK spends 10 times as much as the USA in health information technology. All right, but are Americans ready for this? Let's think about it. Here's a map from the Health Information National Trends Survey, that little blue spot up in the IT corridor and health corridor around Harvard and MIT. That shows penetration of people who are online and searching for health information according to the survey in 2003. This is a national probability sample. Let's look what happened in 2005. 2007 is in the field right now. We're seeing a massive spread of people online looking for health information, and specifically looking for information about cancer, which ends up being about number 3 in the list of searched terms at Google and other places. We also see that across a number of different activities, not just health information, we see increases. We see people buying medicine online. We see the beginnings of a system changing to allow for communication between physician and doctor, or physician and patient. And we can ask ourselves, well, okay, that's great, but isn't there a big issue with age? Isn't it something that the Facebook generation does? And we baby boomers don't mess around with that, or certainly those that are older don't mess around with that. Well, we know there's a relationship, but you can also see across every age category an increase in use of health information technology and looking for information on the web. And we think as these generations continue to pan out, we're going to see a good population, a good part of the population, empowered to do this. All right, but I know that if we look at other sectors of the economy that have been transformed by information technology, haven't they really proceeded because of a dissemination and distribution of broadband? My behavior is different when I'm on broadband. Well, in fact, if you look at the red part of this pie, you'll see a diffusion of broadband as well. So we're seeing more reliance on broadband, and as Susanna Fox, who's in the audience from Pew, would like to say, this means that we do, in fact, do different things online. We can control our weight. We can work on smoking cessation programs. There's a lot that we can do. So let's go and look in the United States. Let's look at other industries that have been successful, and this is something I borrowed from Dr. Holly Massett. One thing we have in the United States, we certainly see that we have an infrastructure available for us in the financial industry. Most of us manage our own wealth care online. That took about 20 years for us to go from that ATM down to Rio de Janeiro last week, or Luxembourg, or China, and draw money out of an account that I could look at with my web browser today. That took 20 years for that to evolve. But can we do the same kind of thing in medicine? And if so, what might that look? Well, the Centers of Excellence in Cancer Communication Research we talked about, that's been a significant investment in behavioral research that can be deployed on a computer module. So now we don't have to pay the expense of a very expensive therapist or group sessions, but we can allow people to self-engage in something like smoking cessation. And through randomized controlled trials, we're finding significant decreases in smoking behavior from people who go through this kind of online module. We're also investing in small business innovation research grants. If it's the case, as Tom Friedman said, that the world is flat, and while we're sleeping, this thing became global, then we can take those investments and move them into a global world, a global economy, and we can have a bigger impact than just on the United States if we do this right. And that's the key, if we do this right. So if we have tobacco consumption only over the next 50 years, we can avert 150 million premature deaths worldwide. These are staggering numbers to think about as we think about health information technology. We can move into that second window of opportunity, so screening. We have, in fact, access programs in the National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program, but the problem has always been linking people to those access programs. So can we use an ATM equivalent in the health world, these educational kiosks, and in fact, we've invested on ways of doing that, and linking that now to local communities and providers. Can we move on patient education and so on? Then something from the department that we're pursuing, the Department of Health and Human Services, and all the way down from the White House, is to create a system in health that resembles a financial system in the sense that there are interoperable personal medical records. And if we have these medical records or health records that are electronic and interoperable and that follow you over a lifespan, now we can do even more in a behavioral sense. We can start reminding you about when it's time to think about that screening. We can make it easy for you to go in and see your physician at those key points in life. It's a life-sensitive streaming electronic medical record. And if we move in this direction, we find out that the new era of information technology is enamored with the notion of a social technology, a connective technology. That's what's different about this revolution than the revolution from 10 or 15 years ago. If this is a connective technology, can we create networks of care? Can we help ourselves help others so that if we can't reach people directly with the technology, can we reach beyond the technology through support networks? And you'll notice if you go to our website, you'll find a new compendium of research on patient-centered communication and cancer care. You're welcome to download that or order it, and we'll send it to you for free. And then finally, the whole institute, the whole agency at NIH, sees a world enabled by genetic information, enabled by new biomarkers and pharmaceutical developments that is personalized. And we need to have our information technology get caught up on that personalization. So we see a world panning out that, in fact, will be predictive, personalized, and preemptive, and that's what we need help for. We know in our department that we can't do this alone. As a behavioral psychologist myself, I know that I've had to rely on people in the medical setting to understand how behavior would fit into the pain that's being experienced in the clinic. We need to do the same thing now and reach out to our colleagues in the private sector who are dealing with issues of information technology in a consumer level. So we've invited three stellar panelists, and these folks have a very booked dance card. It's amazing that they were able to come. It's a testament to what Lindsay has done and what others have done, but I think more importantly, it's a testament to their desire to make a change in the world related to health. So we have three. We have Adam Bosworth, that many of you may have known if you've been living on the blogosphere for a while, was really the mastermind behind Google Health, and is now, just recently, and I'll let him tell you about what this means, moved into a new company, a new startup, and he can tell you a little bit about probably that. Kias, is that the name of the company, Adam? So he'll be our first speaker. After that, we're going to ask Bern Shin to speak, and so Bern, you didn't mind that I brought Andy Groves up. Bern, in the past, is a physician. He's been right at the cutting edge of emergency medicine, of pharmacological medicine, and anyone who associates themselves with the Institute of Medicine and knows what IT can do to help us with drug-to-drug interactions, understand why he probably is interested in IT, was with the Institute for the Future for a while, and is now at Intel and their chief healthcare strategist for Intel's digital health group. And then finally, after that, we'll turn it over to Bill Crowns, Dr. Bill Crowns, who comes to us from Washington State, where it's rainy here, too, and I apologize for that. We heard Dr. Crowns speak about a year and a half ago at MedNet. And, Bill, I was very impressed with what you had done. your vision of how healthcare is changing and sort of the five things to be looking at in the world of healthcare change, that we can pay attention to at NIH and we can help add momentum to what it is that you're trying to accomplish at Microsoft. So with that introduction, I'd like to turn it over to the panel.
It's rare that I feel that my entire talk has been stolen by the introduction, but with some chagrin I have to acknowledge that's essentially what's done, because one could boil my entire talk down to empower consumers and then help them modify their behavior, which I believe was largely what was just being recommended. I did think hard about this talk before I came in terms of what can IT actually do to help, and I was asked to answer some fairly highfalutin questions, like what is my vision for consumer health IT, which is not an easy thing to answer. I want to start by saying that I'm actually relatively new to healthcare. I was looking over the bios of my fellow panelists, and Bernie was cutting his teeth on molecular biology and organic chemistry and stuff at a time when I was still learning about how the Vietnamese dynasties worked and studying East Asian history. So my awakening to the world of health started more recently. I spent 25 years, really from the time I was 23 to 48, building what I now politely call Lego blocks for adults. And Lego blocks for adults were ways to help people automate their systems. And in the course of building the Lego blocks for adults, I did actually learn one or two things that may turn out to be useful as we think through how do we make IT work for the area of health. But at some point I woke up and thought to myself, what do you want to do for the next 25 years? And I decided to try and do something more useful, which was actually cause people to be healthier and live longer to the extent that I could help. And so after my misspent youth, I'm now spending my time focusing on health and trying to understand it and mostly wandering around asking lots of stupid questions until I do. In the course of building the stuff that I did in the first 25 years, though, I learned a few lessons that I'm going to come back to as we talk about what IT can do for health. And one is that not everybody is the same. Sounds pretty obvious, but if you actually look at how a system gets built by IT, a very common problem you see is that professional programmers go ahead and build tools for professional programmers. Now, this is great if they're building a tool for professional programmers, but it turns out not to work so well if they're building someone for the rest of us. And most of us have used software that we can easily say was clearly built by the programmer for the programmer, because it's a stellar example of both abstraction and complexity. While abstraction and complexity are the bread and butter of professional programmers, they are not necessarily what my mom wanted when she was trying to get advice on how to deal with cancer after she was in remission. Quite the contrary. And yet the search experience for a lot of people today is still very much like that experience. And a different group that we don't talk about much outside the industry are what I politely call scripters. In the medical arena, this would probably be unthinkable. Most people go through their, a formal training program, go to medical school, do their residency, et cetera, and then go off and practice medicine. Not so in software. In software, very large numbers of people, about 10 times as many as studied computer science, go off and practice computer science in the sense that they write code without ever having studied it at all. It is as though people went in the emergency room and started operating with great glee, having never gone to medical school for even a minute. And the results can be pretty much what you'd expect. And given that those are the results, we've learned the hard way how to build tools that, in some sense, protect these people from themselves. And the reason that this is germane is that much of the web is built by scripters. While the people who build the tools for the scripters are professional programmers, most of the websites you go to are actually not built by professional programmers, unless they're very big ones like Google, or Facebook. And even Facebook went through an interesting transition a year into their life where they actually sort of purged a certain number of people in the company who would be called scripters and replaced them with people called professional programmers. I bring this up in part because I see this happen a lot in the health IT arena. I was at a lab the other day looking at an extraordinary job of people basically telling customers, patients, which HIV medicines would still work for them given where they were in their HIV. And what happened was they were taking a drop of people's blood, running some clever machinery to sequence out separate the HIV virus, then sequence it, then running a bunch more complicated technology, which frankly was classic scripter code, written by a very smart doctor who had not studied computer science, to try and turn that into a model where he could then look up all of the different sequence variations, all the mutations, and then say, okay, these are the medicines that will still work, these are medicines that might work, and these are medicines that definitely are no longer going to work. Now, the fact that this worked was impressive. The fact that the doctor had to sit there and write a bunch of code was not. In fact, it was appalling, because if you look at the numbers that I have here, for every person who can write script, there are 10 people who can understand how to use tools, but are not actually people going to go out and write programmers. And as I'll talk about in a moment, most people in the health industry fit straight in the description of power users, and most of them do not fit into the model of scripters. And then lastly, we have the people we're trying to serve, and we need to keep them in mind. And I was very happy with the introduction in that sense, because it doesn't do any good to work out what would work for people if they don't use it. And this is a very important point that gets overlooked over and over and over again. Also notice that this is not a spectrum. People do not move from being power user to scripter. And so when you see someone as a health professional go, oh, okay, I'll learn programming in order to write a website, this is probably not a good idea. Occasionally it works, usually it doesn't. So I do think that there are some lessons learned in terms of thinking about how do we build tools to help people take the knowledge we have about health or the knowledge we ought to have about health and translate it into actually creating better health outcomes for more people. But they start by understanding who we're talking about. When we talk about doctors and health professionals, they are classic power users if I ever saw one. They are definitely not people who try and use code, despite my experience in that lab. They are very comfortable with abstraction. They are even more comfortable with complexity. In fact, most of us, when we look at medical training, are overwhelmed by the amount of complexity. Just the terminology that people use for heart attack leaves the rest of us reeling. You know, we say heart attack, and they have various forms of myocardial infarction, and we're all going, well, why can't you just say heart attack? Because there's four different flavors of how the system failed before they even get started. So complexity and abstraction are not a problem for the average health professional. The patients, on the other hand, are classic end users. They are looking neither for abstraction nor complexity. They're just trying to find simple answers. And when they're overwhelmed by complexity, they tend to give up. They're looking for very simple ways to understand what they should do and how they should do it. And in your arena, the arena of cancer, one of the things we tend to ignore is what happens the moment the patient is declared as being having a remission. When the patients are actually really sick and they're in the hospital getting chemo all the time, the patients actually have someone looking over their shoulder and holding their hand and watching them, and they don't have to think that much about what to do. They don't have to take charge of their own destiny as much. But the moment they're declared in remission, it's as though they were dropped through a trap door and dumped into a cold ocean. And at that point, no one is looking out for them. And if there's not some tools to help them look out for themselves, they tend to be panicked and they tend not always to do the right things. And then we have the people building the practice management systems and the health apps on the web. And it's important, again, to understand that these people may not be professional programmers. And understanding how to empower these people to actually deliver the right information to these patients in ways that the patients can use and understand productively is very important. One of the questions that Lindsay asked me to talk about was, what problems can IT help with in health? Well, there are a few. We have a small number of basic problems in health today, which I would argue scream for support from information technology. We are not learning in an easy way from everyone's research. It took me a while to discover this. When I first got into the world of health, I thought, oh, everybody shares all their data. The data is reusable. We can just crawl the web of data and easily learn what everyone else has learned about what research shows. Well, we know that this is not the case. And the fact that this is not the case is unfortunate. It's as though you could not read anyone's web pages unless you were a private member of a private site for each and every site. And even then, they wouldn't be interoperable. And you would need a different browser to go to each and every site. And that would not work as well. We had that. It was called the world before the web. We are not truly and carefully tracking the evidence on most treatment protocols or differential diagnostic rules. When I first joined the Institute of Medicine's evidence-based model, I was assuming, again, that all differential diagnostics and all treatment rules were basically backed up by lots and lots and lots of solid evidence. It was an eye-opener to actually be part of that working group for a while. We don't have as much data as we should. IT is good at gathering data. Google basically lives and breathes every day by making intelligent use of data. The system today is focused on sickness. It is not focused on keeping people well. And this is a terrible cost to us, both in terms of cost, but also in terms of human well-being and in terms of productivity, things that we sometimes don't count when we're talking about how badly that system works. And if we can, in fact, affect behavioral modification, we could change that. And that is more dramatic, as was mentioned, just in terms of tobacco, honestly, than all of the personalized medicine, all the intelligent oncology we could do for the next 10 years, just in terms of saving human lives. The lack of convenience is appalling compared to modern consumer solutions. And again, it was convenient. It was nice. You stole my speech to see IKEA. But, you know, for modern consumers, from eating to travel to purchasing goods, we tend to do this online and effortlessly. And yet, I can't schedule a doctor's appointment online. I can't easily find a good doctor or a good hospital online. I can't pick and choose between them or check them out. I can't track my medical history or take ownership of it. In fact, I'm not even legally allowed to go into a lab, get some tests that I'd want to get, and take them home and add them to my medical record if I chose to. And that makes no sense whatsoever. And IT clearly could deliver these sorts of things. We're good at this. We don't track people's health longitudinally, nor do we let them do it. If you go to India and you talk to the doctors there, the doctors give the records back to the patient. And if the patients are expected to hang on to these things, keep them organized, and bring them back to the next doctor. And thinking about that, I realized that in many cases, they're going to get much better quality care than we will, because they at least have a longitudinal pattern of what's been going on in their life. When I walk into my doctor and my doctor takes my PSA score or talks to me about colonoscopy, my doctor has absolutely no context whatsoever except what's my memory happens to serve. And I actually, to be honest, don't remember where I had the last two PSA tests and what the scores were. And so I can't tell the doctor whether I'm getting worse, better, or the trend is going up. And I'm typical. I'm not atypical of the consumer experience. Just having longitudinal data owned by the patient would be a huge improvement. We have clearly failed to keep our population healthy. I was at the Aspen Institute looking at a health session a few weeks ago, and they just put up a chart showing the prevalence of early onset diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and obesity. And it was like watching one of those alien viruses spread across the country. And so, you know, looking at, and that's just in the last 20 years. So looking at that in terms of what that means for us all and how we could, again, help through behavior modification is key. We do not have any deep understanding of how to personalize treatments for cancers. In sharp contrast to that HIV story I just talked about, where at least they could tell you exactly which medicines would work for you, if you go in to have treatment for breast cancer or ovarian cancer, as soon as the first basic slew of medicines stop working, people just start to guess at this point. I asked, when my mom was getting ovarian cancer chemo, I said, well, you know, are you sequencing the tumor? And they just looked at me and they said, we could, and we wouldn't know what to do with it if we did. You know, we're at a point now where we're just basically picking medicines that might work. And we're hoping to find out. And there's not enough data for us to know. We don't collect nearly enough data on combined genotypic, phenotypic, proteomic data to intelligently reason and learn from it. So there are plenty of problems for IT to go and help with. Most of these require, honestly, more help politically than technically. You know, to get the system to worry about health rather than sickness, for example, it would probably help if the system worked more like Kaiser in general, and people had a lifetime view, and that would mean the universal coverage and the people who insure you understanding that they're on the hook for you for life, so they might as well start focusing on your long-term cost over your lifetime rather than your short-term cost. And that is not something that, per se, IT can help with. So I focus less on that when I sort of put this talk together than things that the IT arena could do. It is crazy to me that people can't routinely get basic tests without going through a doctor. It is crazy to me that it's as though I couldn't buy and sell stocks without going to a financial analyst, only one who is overworked, has less than ideal listening skills, and only has 10 minutes for me every few months. Mostly, though, I think that the solution for these problems is to change three very basic parts of the system. And this is really what I focused on as I work on how IT can help health. The first is to change the model to one where patients own their own data, understand that they are responsible for their data, can easily collect it and share it with others who can help them to manage their health. And this really was my main thrust and effort at Google. It was interesting to use banking as an analogy because my mental image was always I'm trying to build the ATM for health data. Something which is an information highway so that I, as a consumer, anytime I have any interaction that affects my health record, can pull that data together, aggregate it, and then manage that data as I see fit. And I still believe that that is one of the most important and most seminal things that health IT can do to start to affect change. Because then you have an empowered consumer group with a lot of data that they can bring to people who have the expertise to start helping them do the right thing. But the second thing is to make it possible for the doctors to do what they do so well. In the course of the last 3 years, talking to the medical community, I have yet to meet a doctor who doesn't care. Maybe one or two, but by and large, I have yet to meet a doctor who doesn't care. I have yet to meet a doctor who doesn't understand what their patients should be doing and could be doing to keep track of their health and monitor and manage their health on their own. They simply do not have the time and the ability and the willing and to deliver that knowledge back to the patient. If we can help the health community to keep a constant eye on people, to help them stay healthy without either having to become programmers, which, as I just pointed out, is not plausible, or dedicating tens of hours to each of us each year, then we can make a huge change. And that actually is really what I'm working on next, is how can we help the medical community help people modify their behavior in a much more leveraged way than the model we have today. And then lastly, make it easy for researchers to test new protocols and ideas without huge costs. I was chatting with a guy called Bill Hazeltine a few weeks ago about how much we spend today per drug delivered or new treatment delivered versus how much we spent 20 years ago. And according to him, and I haven't checked these numbers, we spend about 15 times as much today, 15 to 20, and we have exactly the same number of drugs and protocols being delivered today as we did 15 years ago. In short, we're spending 15 times as much for the same amount of productivity. Now, that is exactly the reverse of what is happening in the rest of the industry due to IT. In general, things have gotten much cheaper and much faster to deliver because of technology. In general, what ought to have happened is we ought to be delivering, if we're spending 15 times as much, 30 to 40 times as much in terms of protocols and drugs. Clearly, this is not happening. And a major part of this is because it is expensive for people to just try and test out a new idea, test out a new protocol, deliver one. I actually hear people now talking about the entire business of health research going offshore to India simply to try and cut down these costs. Well, that's one choice for us, but another choice is to figure out how to deliver much cheaper and more cost-effective solutions. And again, the secret to that is not to ask every single researcher to cover every single column on this chart, but to give them the tools they need to, as power users, very quickly and easily build and deploy and test using the protocols they understand. If we can create a market for consumers, we'll create a huge market for medical expertise. And if we don't step in to help people, health professionals from other nations will step in to fill the holes. This is the Internet, and there are no national barriers on it. We'll get second opinions. We'll get warnings about inappropriate drugs, better information about new regimes, and frankly, more convenience will follow. The important point to understand is that people do not look about data. They look about services. Just as a good retirement program needs my financial data as context to give me the best help and advice, medical expertise needs my health data as a context to give me the best help and advice. People are not looking for a PHR. They're looking for help and advice. One of the failures of the industry has been that they've been out selling PHRs to customers. Customers don't want PHRs. They want help and advice. And they will be happy to work hard to collect the data that they need for getting that help and advice, just as they are happy today to get it for what you called wealth advice or wealth care. And that's an important point for us to remember. If we deliver a model that makes it easy for the health professionals to actually deliver personalized advice, care, monitoring, and behavior modification into our customers, and we've already delivered on the first promise, then we will start to see major changes. We will start to see that people can manage their health in a personalized way, and the moment something goes wrong, start to take appropriate action. Now, when I started thinking about this, I was thinking only about things like obesity and the onset of diabetes. But the moment I started to engage with doctors, they started pointing out to me things that would never have occurred to me, like pregnancy. Now, to me, pregnancy is, yes, you get pregnant, you have a kid. To them, it's, okay, the following things need to be watched for at the following times. If you don't see these following things, you should get alarmed. If you don't have these tests at this point, you should get alarmed because you should have had these tests at this point. The following things should no longer be eaten or drunk. You know, and as doctors, I assume that all of you take this for granted. But for the rest of us, the people who were not doctors, none of this would have ever occurred to us. And so having that information constantly at our fingertips is key. If, in fact, we could harness the power of the health community in the way that I'm describing, even if 1/100th of the doctors out there, and only 1/100th could deliver, that is 10,000 people contributing on an ongoing basis to helping people improve their lives, leveraged by the power of the Internet to deliver that into patients, and it would change health profoundly compared to what we know today, where maybe a few hundred programmers actually understand health and are delivering the right information to the right people at the right time. Lastly, this is all science. We still need to enable the researchers. As I said, it's the cost of delivering drugs right now makes no sense at all in terms of the cost of producing and doing the research compared to the cost of everything else having dropped dramatically. And so one of the things that I've been looking at is how can we come up with cheaper ways for people to understand how to put together new protocols, test those protocols, and deliver them. And part of it, again, is thinking about how do you empower these people? If you ask these people to build their own websites, build their own trial management systems, build their own ways for tracking the data, build their own data analysis, build their own ways to prove that that data is valid, build their own control models, build their own ways to do cohort theory, because sometimes you can't have simple controls, clearly very few numbers of people are going to be able to run these tests. If you build people what at Microsoft we used to call a platform, a tool where basically all of this is built in, and you're simply tailoring or customizing this tool in a way that you as a normal power user can do to build the own specific things that you need to test for and modify, then all of a sudden the number of people who can do it goes up by 100-fold and the cost of it goes down by 100-fold. And that really is what we should be looking at. Why is the cost of building better procedures and better drugs not dropped by 100-fold? Not 5-fold, not 10-fold, but 100-fold over the last 20 years, because it ought to have. The cost of many other things have. So what is my vision then? First, and most of this was stolen by you, let the consumer control and own his or her own health data electronically and in a computable form. This is the one place where occasionally I and Microsoft have differed. I do not see the value of having data assembled online if the data can't be used intelligently by people in an interoperable way. What do I mean when I say a computable form? That if someone is taking various medicines and they have that in their record, you understand what medicines they're taking. If you use words to describe the medicine, that is not a reliable mechanism. If you use codes, it is. If someone has diagnosis, you understand the diagnosis. If someone has an allergy, you understand the allergy. These are very basic things. If someone has lab results, you understand the lab results. It is surprisingly hard to get people to just pull together this very simple knowledge. I'm not talking about the complex kinds of medical histories that people having heart surgery have. I'm not talking about the complex histories that people having cancer have. I'm talking about the most basic information possible. And just getting that information into a computable and reusable form would change healthcare very dramatically. And when I'm asked what government can do to help, one of the things government could do to help is to basically make sure that this occurs, that it's free and that it's easy. The government is focused so far on interoperable formats, but not on interoperable encodings. And the encodings are actually what make things computable. The formats, frankly, programmers are smart. If you give us 5 different formats, we'll figure out how to translate between them. However, if you write down a lot of English words for procedures, and they're all different, then it's actually very hard for us to figure out what procedure you actually had. So having reliable codes, to me, is important. Secondly, empower the health professional to deliver personalized health and medical advice to people as easily as financial people build spreadsheets. And when you can do that, I think you deliver a tidal wave of testable expertise directly to those who need it. I've been working with this in a small way with a small number of doctors, and the one thing I've seen is that their productivity is going up enormously because all they have to think about is what are the rules and what do they need to tell people, not how do they go and build websites, not how do they go and do data analysis, not how do they go and test these theories. And they know this stuff. It's at their fingertips, particularly the younger doctors. They're very aware of what people should be doing in every step of the way, what things they should be looking out for. Third, I think we need to build an equivalently easy way for researchers to design and build and test protocols with access to the same consumers when they choose to sign up. And I hope that if we do this, we will drop the cost of designing and testing useful treatments and protocols 100-fold. So this is, in my opinion, what IT can do, should do, and must do to deliver a better healthcare, both to the U.S. and the rest of the world. And it's largely what I'm planning to be working on for the next 20 years. Thank you.
Well, I think Adam's remarks are very apropos. I see the disadvantage of not having my laptop with me on the stage because I can't modify my talk at the last minute. There is, in fact, a lot of convergent thinking going on here, which is great. I'll actually sort of pivot one of Adam's tables. I'll also borrow some material from Bob and from Brad and from some of the folks here in the audience. So here's my take on what we can do in the health IT industry and consumer-facing industries to perhaps advance the mission of the NCI and NIH. Now, one question that some of you may be asking is why Intel and what is Intel doing here? Many of you, the Intel that you know, of course, relates to Moore's Law and to the chips that we make. We can make transistors now that are on the same order of magnitude as influenza virus in terms of size. But there's also the Intel that you may not know, which is that a few years ago we started a digital health group, among other groups at Intel. And this is where my background comes from for today's talk. Now, Brad mentioned translation, and I think that if you think about T1 and T2, really in the scale from molecules to individuals to society or policy, T1 occurs between bench to bedside, and T2 mostly between bedside and practice. But really, when you think about it, these are really translations among professionals. Generally, the researchers are talking to physicians. Physicians are talking to policymakers. And I think what I would propose is that, in a way, what you're trying to address today, what we're talking about, are other forms of translation, T3, if you will, between the researchers disseminating the research results to the public, to the lay public, and a T4, if you will, translating public policy and practice guidelines to the patients, much as Adam talked about with his own experience when his mom had cancer. So I think that if we think about these new kinds of translation that up till now hasn't been necessarily a large part of the NIH or NCI agenda, but I think is rapidly becoming more so, we see things like the following. And, of course, we've already seen the slide from Hintz. But, in fact, there's been some great research done on this campus and elsewhere on this. And, likewise, your own Learning and Listening Together conference just a few months ago this year. Now, beyond this, there's a rich ecosystem of other activities that are going on. And these are just a few of the many efforts going on in the country and elsewhere. As you can see, some of these are from government agencies and parts of the NIH itself. Others are from the private sector. Others are even international in scope. Many of you are familiar with the work that Kate Lorig has done in patient education, Vic Strecker at Michigan, Molly Mettler and her colleagues at the Center for Information Therapy. There's really a lot of interesting information going on with this sort of T3 and T4, if you will, translation. Susanna Fox and her colleagues at the Pew, as was cited again, there's this good convergent thinking going on, have also taken a look at what are consumers doing online. And much as Adam is going to be devoting his next 20 years to, I think all of us are sort of saying, well, in fact, if you do have a chronic disease, are you more likely to be affected by and to engage with health information? Now, there are interesting mutations going on in this market as well. The so-called serious gaming community, as many of you know, is growing in size to the point where Robert Wood Johnson has actually issued an $8.2 million RFP recently to sort of say, how can we improve the effectiveness and the impact of serious games, whether it's Dance Dance Revolution for exercise, whether it's things like, as many of you know, the cancer game, Ben's game, or remission for patients and children with cancer. Or in other domains as well, things like GlucoBoy and games to teach diabetics how to manage their disease. So there's sort of new entrants. Some of us in the consumer-facing industries are really sprinting very quickly to understand these, and I really commend you for providing us the forum today to talk about this as well. Going beyond gaming, there are also a whole adjacent space of virtual worlds. As you know, there are many folks in Second Life who are part of cancer groups. This is just a few of those on the right-hand side of the slide here. And the CDC, among others, has their own health information kiosk on Health Info Island. So I think when you think about this, really what we're talking about is a series of new approaches to translating the research that's the important bench research that's done here and the clinical research that's done around the country into actionable, perhaps computable, results for patients. We all know the fundamental healthcare issues of cost, quality, and access, not always in the same order, have to be addressed. And we all know that with the so-called rectangularization of the survival curve, in the old days, most people died very early, as you can see in the slide here. As we've made medical advances, more and more people are surviving to old age. But the problem is, of course, that although we're getting older, we may not necessarily be more healthy. So you may recognize this cover art from The Economist a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, we are evolving to a stage where many of us do have chronic disease. What this means is that with more as you get older, you get more chronic disease. This leads to consumption and utilization of health resources, and such that the older you get, the more costly your care. Now, last year, some of you know, we passed a watershed moment when the cost of health insurance for a family of four in the U.S., about $11,000, actually exceeded for the first time the average annual wages of a minimum wage worker. So there's clearly something wrong with the system. It won't scale, and I'll touch on this just a little bit more. Now, stepping back just a bit, certainly the context around what we're talking about today is that healthcare per se is only a small part of the input to health outcomes. Some of you will recognize this diagram from the special issue in 2003 of the Health Services Research, basically summarizing the fact that health outcomes depend on a lot of things, including behavior, transportation, housing, and so forth, things we don't normally think of as traditionally health domains. I was very impressed. Bill and I first met at the Pacific Health Summit a couple summers ago in Seattle, and I was very impressed when one of the speakers from Japan said that in the Japanese health picture, senior housing is considered an essential part of senior health, because if you don't have housing, you don't have health. And I think that the sort of more holistic notion of what it takes to create good health outcomes is something that we should be adopting. What this leads to is what the Institute for the Future calls boundary markets. If you look at this slide here, in the center is traditional healthcare. It's really surrounded by a penumbra of industries that up till now haven't been considered strictly health, but cosmetics, fashion, beauty, fitness, consumer electronics. What does it mean that you can go to a Radio Shack store and buy a blood pressure monitor? What does it mean that fitness and diet clearly are beginning to bleed into pharmaceuticals through nutraceuticals and functional foods? What does it mean that home security can perhaps be modified to make it give you a sensor network that provides health alarms as well as security alarms? And the design and of the built environment, including homes, will more and more evolve towards smart homes. I also want to stress that much of what we're talking about today occurs outside the traditional focus of academic medicine. Some of you may recognize this diagram from the New England Journal of Medicine article. This is a redo of a 1961 article, 40 years later, on the so-called ecology of healthcare. Now, if you take 1,000 patients per month, about 800 of them will report some sort of symptoms, and about a third of them will actually consider seeking care. But as you can see here in the nested boxes, smaller and smaller fractions will actually go to see an emergency department, be admitted, and less than 1 in 1,000 will actually be admitted to an academic medical center. Much of our attention up till now has been in this lower right-hand corner, when there's this whole larger ecosystem of outpatient medicine, people managing health on their own, as Adam said, drop through that trap door into a cold ocean once you've been diagnosed as being in remission, or once you're diagnosed with a chronic disease but not active. These people are largely on their own and leading to a lot of information needs. So if you take a look at how we frame things at Intel, we take a look at a log scale here on the x-axis of cost of care per day, and on the y-axis, quality of life going from 0 to 100. Really, we're talking about people going from acute care, shifting where the quality of life is arguably quite low, cost of care is quite high, to residential care, eventually to home care or ubiquitous care. And the so-called shift left is what really governs a lot of what we've been thinking about. And some of you have heard Andy Grove and others talk about this. I think if you look at a framework like this, this helps us inform what we're trying to do, which is by empowering patients and consumers with the tools and the information. We hopefully can help them manage themselves, stay at home longer as they get older, and not be pushed down and to the right into acute care settings. Now, about 15 years ago, Mark Weiser started thinking about ubiquitous computing, and this I borrowed this slide from his work. Basically, he said that we have three main eras. In the mainframe era, there was one computer for many people. In the PC era, it was a one-to-one sort of relationship. And eventually we're going to get to ubiquitous computing, where it's a many-to-one relationship. Now, what happens here is that, as you know, the mainframe computer was centralized, heavy, expensive. You had to go there to use it, and you had to consult specialists to use it. As we move more and more to a PC model, it's become decentralized, lightweight, more user-friendly. As Andy Grove has pointed out, this is the medical mainframe, the modern hospital, centralized, expensive, you have to go there to use it, and you have to consult specialists. Why not go to a much more do-it-yourself, decentralized, lightweight, user-friendly model, exemplified by something like the home pregnancy test? So I think that these are some of the trends that all three of us, I believe, have been thinking about on the panel, many of you as well, and from this I'd like to go ahead and talk a little bit more about what this could mean for disruption. If you borrow Clay Christensen's notion here, what this means is that things that originally started out as being toys, such as digital cameras or cheap cars from Toyota or whatever, initially start out being inadequate, is really not up to the job, but eventually they climb up that curve of disruption. And sooner or later, you'll see, as in the slide here, disruption both in terms of point of care and in terms of provider level, things that could be done only in the hospital, increasingly be done in the clinic, in the office, and eventually at home. things that used to be done only by specialists perhaps can be done through technology by primary care docs and eventually patients themselves. Now, how do we attack this in industry? As you know, we start out with unmet needs, and then there's a very clean cascade of requirements, design, implementation, and testing, and so forth. You conduct some focus groups, you do some scientific research, people in white coats, you turn the crank and turn out the solutions, and then you end up with a happy customer. Well, of course, it's not really this simple. We're very aware that often what happens is that what the customer actually wants is quite different, as you can see in the slide here, from what's actually promised, designed, produced, delivered, or installed. So given this, we are quite humble in industry, saying that you really can't do armchair reasoning through this. Really, we have to take a very deep look at people and processes through ethnography. Many of my colleagues have been living with people with Alzheimer's and their families, for example, for years, trying to abstract those practices and processes that Adam talked about. How do they do the workarounds? We sit down with interaction designers and social scientists to brainstorm ideas and eventually then develop prototypes, pilots, and eventually perhaps platforms and products. This is a slide that very quickly and glibly summarizes a very difficult procedure. It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and I'll just give you an example of it here. This is a slide borrowed from my colleague Eric Dishman, a very familiar scene to everybody in the audience here. So what's going on here? What's this guy doing with the chair? Well, as some of you recognize, that's the attending physician. As the attending, he's the only one who can sit down during presentations and rounds. And so he drags his chair around with him all around the wards just to show that he can sit down. He never did actually sit down, but but just to show that he could and nobody else could. So what's the lesson here? The lesson here is that power matters, right? And that if you introduce new technology into this setting, it might actually upset the power structures and the normal way of doing business. Likewise, here's another photo that's getting a little bit old, but some nice computers and monitors in the ward, and yet what are people dealing with? The paper artifacts. So what does this mean? Why is it that paper has such good affordances for many tasks in healthcare? And what does it mean if we're trying to introduce technology, appropriate technology, into the setting in terms of specification and design? So we've done quite a bit of work with how nurses, for example, and other healthcare workers deal with information. Of course, you recognize what IBM here used to call the pools of illiquidity, health information illiquidity. Adam talked about the ATM. Brad, I think, talked about the ATM of medicine as well. A few years ago, IBM Almaden Institute said, if you look at the notion of health information liquidity, it's the same thing as trying to free up those stagnant pools that currently reside in paper records and in non-interoperable systems. And what can we do to free that up? If you take a look at how nurses, for example, record information on the ward. Some of it is with formal forms, some of it's informal, some of it quite informal on the bottom there, scribbled on the back of an alcohol wipe. We really did a lot of hundreds of hours of observation, thematic clustering of the observations, and design then of something that could be spray disinfected, something that didn't require a fan to cool the computer, things that had a barcode reader, a camera, good ergonomics and so forth, things that people would actually use in a real-world setting. And so this isn't an earth-shattering product, but it's one of those things that sort of tries to encapsulate deep thinking about what consumers or the end users really need. And we'd like to apply this now to other domains as well. So some of you recognize this map. This is a map of the world in 2025 with the geographies distorted to reflect the absolute numbers of people over 65. Now, demographers and cartographers will quibble with the methodology of maps like this, but this certainly points to an important issue of aging. And we've begun to do ethnography of seniors around the world. Here are some folks in Europe, including, I love this woman in the lower right-hand corner who's really breaking on some of the stereotypes around aging, doing some rock climbing there, but saying, you know, what does it mean to get old? And this is a wonderful woman, Penny by name, 90 years old in Ireland, who has a TV in her upstairs bedroom. She's moved in with her daughter, finally. She has a TV that's unplugged, and when our ethnographers asked us, what's going on with that TV? She says, oh, that's for when I really get old and can't get around the house. I'll be able to plug it in and use it. Here she is, 90 years old, still trying to stay active. It's really wonderful. Or James, a widower, talking about missing his wife 6 years after losing her to cancer. And, you know, again, what's going on here and how can we help through technology? How can we help them manage the issues of social isolation, depression, as well as their own somatic health issues? What this means is that people really have established what the Institute for the Future calls a personal health ecology, a very complex network of resources and activities to help them deal with health issues. This is a sort of a crude segmentation, but if you say, you look at the slices of pie here, there are issues related to technology, to personal relationships, to activities, and so forth. And these slices may grow and shrink over time. Initially, right after your diagnosis with cancer, for example, the slice of pie related to providers may really expand. You're spending a lot of time with your providers. But perhaps down the road, when some of the treatments have failed, you may actually spend less time with providers and more time in the relationships slice of pie, saying goodbye to people, saying the things that really matter. So I think thinking about this very complex personal health ecology, there are many ways and many places that technology can help. Dealing with cognitive decline, here's some photos from our research. Carl in the so-called, I'll call him Carl in the upper left-hand corner, is forgotten. He's beginning to forget who his family members are, so he has flashcards up in his refrigerator. The woman with a walker on the upper right-hand corner is actually a caretaker for her 90-year-old mother lying down the couch. And many of them have notes such as you see in the bottom of the slide saying, you know, Dad, every evening, put away your clothes or lock the door or don't touch these pills. Now, these are information transfer tasks, things that are very well suited to IT. Barbara here in this photo became afraid of answering the phone. She was a very sociable person, but she didn't want to answer the phone anymore because she was embarrassed by not recognizing the people on the other side, on the other end. And her husband said when she lost her support network, she really became very depressed, lost everything. So we've been experimenting with how can you have a so-called caller ID on steroids. When the phone rings, perhaps it'll remind you, this is your friend Kevin, last time you talked, here's what she talked about. Barbara and her family would like to know, the guilty boomer daughter across the country wants to know that, you know, mom is at home and okay. So we've been experimenting with so-called ambient displays. The lava lamp that you see there is something that is in her daughter's house across the country. When mom's home and the sensor network says that everything is okay, the gas stove is turned off, the doors are locked and so forth, the lamp glows a certain color. If things aren't okay, it glows another color. Now this saves her from having to call her mom, saves her mom from having to call her every 5 minutes. We've also taken a look at how to encode things like social health. Adam talked about the fact that you really can't work very well with English language words and with very fuzzy concepts. So how can you display very complex information and visualize it? Now, if you take a look at someone's social health, it's composed of all kinds of interactions over time. And you may have more phone conversations or fewer, depending on what's going on. More face-to-face conversations, IM, chat, whatever. And so we said in the lower right-hand corner, perhaps there's a way to display this with a person at the center of a so-called solar system. Friends and family are orbiting around them. And over time, as there's more or less contact, people drift in or out. And very quickly, you can sort of see whether somebody's social health is improving and people are coming in closer to them, or whether it's actually they're getting more isolated for some reason, maybe dementia or cognitive issues, and people are drifting away. Now, people have joked that this is really just the inheritance detector, but certainly when people do get closer in, at least people have a healthier lifestyle. Another big issue, of course, is medication adherence. As I don't need to tell you, med adherence is a huge problem. And as you can see in the figures here, if we can only help people take medications the way that they've been prescribed, we can actually make a huge difference in health outcomes. And in fact, it's been estimated by WHO and Brian Haynes that increasing the effectiveness of adherence will probably do more than all the other interventions that we could do in terms of new modalities. So we've been experimenting with context-aware medication prompting. Now, having a pill box that beeps at you every 3 hours or 4 hours isn't particularly a good way to go. You might be asleep, you might be talking on the phone, you might be out and about, and people don't want to be stigmatized with a pill box that says, hey, this person is sick and has to take pills. But what if you coupled the pill box to sensors? Very simple motion sensors such as you see here, phone, bed sensors. What if you coupled it with actuators and reminders? We actually borrowed, Bill, thanks very much, the Microsoft Spotwatch here, and among other things, but ways to give audio alarms or reminders. What if you actually routed calls to their cell phone so they could very discreetly, while out and about, take a call saying, by the way, Bern, it's time to take your medication, run through a system here. And so I'll just give you a flavor in one of my last slides here for the kinds of information and data that this now generates. What you see here are sort of two channels of information. At the bottom there is the bed sensor, bed pressure. On the top are sensors, motion sensors, in different parts of the home, phone, living room, closet, bedroom, bathroom, and so forth. And what you see that it, here is that in a 24-hour period, there are three times in the middle of the night where the person got up to go to the bathroom and triggered the Bensetzners and the bathroom alarm alarms and so forth. They got up for real around 9 o'clock in the morning. What a luxury, right? And then they puttered around the house. You could see them moving around the house. Very little signal from the bed itself. Perhaps around 1 o'clock they finally made the bed, which is where that little spike occurs in the bottom channel. And then they left the house during this period of time here. Now what you're seeing here really is a choreography, a notation of the person's daily activities. And as some of you know, there are notations for choreographing dance and movement. The question is, are we now able to create and introduce new data types that whether they're a little more complicated than vital signs, but new data types that will require aggregation, fusion, visualization, analysis, and eventually action. If we can actually acquire these and aggregate them over populations, what might it mean? And can we use these then to support patients at home? Now, much of what we've talked about today has really been around understanding information, moving information, but eventually it has to be translated into action. And I think that I really look forward to the discussion and the Q&A to flesh this out some more. Now, many of you know this is the Healthy People 2010 diagram. And in the intersection of health and technology, I think I would argue the only thing that's missing from this very nice diagram is the role of technology. So I would break that out explicitly for us today and say if an individual actually exists in a physical and a social milieu with a biological sort of substrate overlaying with behavior, policies, and so forth, what can technology do to help? Many of us in the consumer-facing industries have been wrestling with this for a long time. The work and research that you've been doing brings a tremendous richness that we don't have. I think by combining these, we can really make a difference. So thank you very much. So next, I'm pleased to bring up Bill. Again, we met about 2 years ago. I really admire his work at Microsoft and look forward to hearing it.
Okay, and to get my slides up, while he's doing that, maybe I'm supposed to do that. He's supposed to do that. Okay, somebody's supposed to do that. Here he is. Did you also plug this in? It is plugged in, right?
Yes. Is this yours, right?
Yes.
Okay, sure.
And is it plugged in?
The
power?
No.
Good morning. My name is Bill from Microsoft. That's pretty easy to remember, except that I'm Dr. Bill, but let's not forget who works for who. I'm actually delighted to be here and to be among such distinguished panelists. A lot of what I do is travel around the world in my role at Microsoft, delivering keynote addresses at major industry conferences and so forth. And I never get tired of it. I get tired of the travel, but I never get tired of interacting with folks in healthcare who want to change the industry, because that's what it's really all about. So what I'm going to share with you today is a condensed version of a talk that I've been giving this last year around the world, which is called 5 Healthcare Trends That Will Shake the World and Reshape Your Organization. This is going to be condensed. Normally, I provide a lot of proof points around each of the 5 trends, but I'm not going to do that today. I'm just going to take you quickly through the 5 trends. And then I will show you a future vision video that we put together at Microsoft that reinforces and talks about these trends. Being an old TV guy, I think that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and it helps convey the message we're trying to get across. And then I'll end by telling you a little bit about something we announced here, actually, in the Washington, D.C. area, on October 4th, and that was the launch of Health Vault, which is a specific application platform, really, for consumers that's all about health. I always start my talks with this slide, and I like to say that I could have had this up 30 years ago, and everybody would nod their head and go, yeah, that's healthcare. There are some differences, though. I'd like to point out, first of all, some of the similarities. Increasing regulation, yeah, it's healthcare. Expensive technology, yes, although we get, I mean, it's like Moore's Law, we get more power for less money, but still expensive technology. Reduced reimbursements. I'll tell you a funny story. I started my career at Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle, a really class place. I spent the first 10 years of my career there, have many good friends and colleagues still working there. And I'll always recall that when I went for my interviews, I was carefully instructed that the one thing I should not talk about is money. Don't ask about salary, don't ask about benefits, just talk about taking care of folks and joining the colleagues and partnership. And that always struck me as kind of amusing, because once I joined Virginia Mason Medical Center, and once I became a partner and sat with the doctors every day in the dining room, the only thing they talked about was money. So as long as I've known doctors, they've been whining about reduced reimbursement. The two new things on this chart, though, are the effect of the aging population, that so-called silver tsunami. And it's not just here in America. It's really across the industrialized world. In fact, much of Europe is a good 10 years ahead of us on this curve, but it's going to have a dramatic impact on our healthcare system. And I'm proud to say I'm one of those folks that's part of that generation. And the other thing is labor shortages. How many healthcare providers do we have in the audience? That few. They've all gotten... So here's what I've observed as I've traveled around the country, is if I ask in a largely healthcare crowd, how many of you are experiencing really labor shortages, deficiencies of certain kinds of specialists, and particularly nurses and surgical nurses, every hand in the place will go up. I mean, this is of real concern. And, you know, it used to be, the way we solved for this in healthcare is we simply begged and borrowed and stole from other countries. So we would import our nurses from the Philippines or from Ireland or someplace. Well, today those economies are developing, expanding, and it's not quite as easy to import those folks anymore. So we're going to confront some significant labor shortage problems here in America. Okay. We know that healthcare is all about data. In fact, I like to call healthcare workers the epitome of the information worker. At Microsoft, we're all about information workers. Well, healthcare workers are the epitome of the information worker. We deal in information work all day long. And unlike my brethren in banking and financial services and retail, the information that we deal in is life and death. And yet, historically, we've had very, very poor tools to deal with all of this data. And one of the things that you may not realize if you don't travel the world and visit other medical centers is that we are in America the worst of the worst in the industrialized world in the use of information technology in healthcare. There is not an industrialized nation. I used to be able to always point out, well, actually Canada is worse. Our neighbors to the north, they're worse. But of course, the Canadian government has been investing billions with a B of Canadian dollars, which as you know are worth more than American dollars these days, in transforming Canadian healthcare. In the UK, they're spending billions of pounds to do the same. And really all across Europe, this has been going on for years. Now, our dear president, God love him, did proclaim that by 2012, I think it is, or 14, what he said was within 7 years, I think, that we will have an electronic health record for most Americans. He didn't say all, but he said most. Well, we're 3 years into that program. However, you'll note that he didn't say government was going to pay for it, so that automatically puts us a little bit behind the eight ball. We're relying on private industry to somehow figure this out. Government investments are very small. And the truth be told is that compared to almost everywhere else, we are behind, drastically behind. And particularly when you look at electronic medical records, physician order entry, the use of clinical decision support systems, we are the worst of the worst. Everybody is ahead of us. And in fact, all told, although the numbers are getting better, and I don't mean to be completely dour here, the numbers are getting better. And it's hard to get your finger on the exact number of doctors in America using electronic medical records. Certainly all big clinics, large enterprise hospitals, yeah. But when we start getting down into under 10 groups, under 5, the onesies and twosies, where 80% of American medicine takes place, the numbers aren't so good there. All up numbers, somewhere around 10, maybe 12%. This slide's a little old, but we still have a long ways to go. That means that even if you take the high end and say 20% of American physicians are using electronic records, that means 80% of this epitome information work, life and death data, is still taking place with pencil and paper in America in 2007. What is it that healthcare workers need? Well, in many ways, you know, I don't entirely blame my colleagues for their slow adoption. And there's lots of reasons behind that. We need the best information worker tools on earth. We do information work. We need great information worker tools. Not all vendor systems have met that mark. Intuitive user interface. You know, I worked in Seattle, Washington, and I'll just give you an example. As a community physician, it's not unusual for us to call on many hospitals. The hospital where I worked had a system called Meditech. If I went up 10 miles up the road to Evergreen Hospital, they had Cerner. If I went 10 miles south on the freeway to Valley Hospital, well, they had IDX, now GE. And if I went into downtown Seattle to Swedish Hospital Medical Center, they would have Epic. Now, I think doctors are pretty smart people. We went to medical school after all, but I can't learn to do my workflow that many different ways, deal with that many different interfaces. So from the get-go, we have a failed system when we have all of these different systems, no matter how good any one of them is, when they all look and behave differently. That doesn't work. Better data input options. You can't throw a keyboard at a doctor or nurse and go at it. That's how you enter your data. Yes, sometimes a keyboard's perfectly adequate, but we want it all. We want digital inking. I want to be able to write on a tablet. I want point and click. I want to use my voice. And I want some data input options that we haven't even invented yet. Clinicians need all of that. People always ask me, well, haven't we been talking about this electronic medical record thing for 40 years in this country? You know, what's taking so long? Well, that fourth bullet point, mobility. Think about it. We didn't really crack the code on mobility until just about 3 or 4 years ago, particularly ubiquitous broadband and mobility, and devices that take advantage of the mobile platform. So that's what's new. And actually, that, I think, is the tipping point for the adoption of electronic records. Interconnected and interoperable, lots of noise about that. National Health Information Network, RIOs, so on and so forth, regional health information networks. It's going to be slow going, but we're getting there. And one of the, if President Bush did nothing else, he started a national debate, a national agenda on this. It's getting some face time in Washington, in D.C., on this. We need interoperable systems, and the vendors, we now have a system to start getting them certified so that there is some level of interoperability. That's crucial. And finally, we at Microsoft believe lower total cost of ownership. Quite frankly, as good as some of the systems are out there, $30,000 to $40,000 to $50,000 a seat just doesn't fly, particularly in primary care. We need systems that are much less costly. Around $1,000 would be nice. Thank you. All right. Now, something else that's holding us back is this. Now, I don't mean to pick on this company alone. It's merely a representation. This is a system that's in 1,800 hospitals in the U.S. and Canada. This is the system that I used in my work at Overlake Hospital Medical Center, where I served as CIO and Chief Medical Information Officer for a number of years. And I remember the first time I sat down with my staff and I saw this thing, and I thought about doctors and nurses using it. And I scratched my head a little bit and I said, gosh, that really reminds me of something. Now, keep in mind, this is in the backyard of Microsoft. This is the hospital where our senior executives go to have their babies, and this green screen thing is what's operating there. And I looked at it and thought about it and said, oh, yeah, I know what that reminds me of. Pong in 1970. Where's the little bouncing ball? Yeah. So, I mean, this is what's out there that, you know, we're asking clinicians, these epitome of the information worker, to use. One of my friends on the East Coast, in New Jersey, sent me this, and I love it. So I'll tell you a little story. So he sends me this series of pictures. He says, Bill, I had a plumber come to my house the other day, a plumber. And this plumber arrived in his GPS-enabled van. He pulled out his Slate tablet PC. He walked into my house and connected to my wireless network. He went up to my toilet, looked it over, ordered some parts. He prevented me an electronic invoice. I signed electronically, and he was out the door. He said, Bill, why isn't healthcare more like that? And of course, I snidely replied, well, you do realize these days that plumber makes a lot more money than your family physician. But this is the consumer experience in every other aspect of our lives, and yet we come to healthcare and we are so far behind. So, The perfect storm is indeed brewing. By the way, there was supposed to be a little audio with that. That didn't happen, so let me check this a little later. Well, he just didn't turn it up. That's okay. So let me share with you five trends that we're thinking about long and hard at Microsoft and how it affects the healthcare industry, and then where we as a technology and platform company can help. Okay, now normally I go in great detail through each of these trends. This is going to be a rather quick journey. Trend number one. I used to call this trend the end of health insurance, but it was so scary when I was before audiences where there were payers that I changed it, and I simply call it now increasing personal responsibility. But the bottom line is this. This is Dr. Bill's rule number one. If you have any money at all, count on the fact that you will be spending more of it for health care. Just keep that in mind. Increasing personal responsibility for costs. And there's a whole bevy of evidence around this. You see what's going on in corporate America, and GM sending back the unions their health plan, corporations bailing out health savings account. Scary figures I reviewed just again this weekend from our government officials looking at Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And you know that last year, apparently for the first time, the income flow or the outcome flow of Medicare dollars exceeded the income flow. And so clearly, and this is before the silver tsunami even really hits the system. So trend number one, if you have any money at all, you will be spending more of it for health care. When consumers start to feel the pain in their wallet, suddenly they get very motivated and very interested. And so I call this really the commoditization of healthcare service. We're seeing it actually, the first evidence of this is the retail movement. You're probably familiar with MinuteClinic and ReadyClinic. Very interesting thing. At Microsoft, we probably have some of the best health benefits for our employees in the world. I mean, I think a lot of people these days are working at Microsoft just for the benefits because they're so good. And the company pays for you and the entire family, no copay, no deductible. I mean, my gosh, we introduced a $40 copay for brand name drugs if a generic is available, and you would have thought the sky was falling a couple of years ago, right? It's a pretty spoiled bunch. Nonetheless, what's interesting, even among our Microsoft employees, we now have, I think, 8 MinuteClinics in our area. I find a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my people I work with at Microsoft on the weekend and so forth, they go to MinuteClinic. Now, it's not about cost in this case. It's about convenience, perceived quality, customer relationship management. Very interesting at MinuteClinic. You walk in, there's a menu. There's a menu board. There's prices. You know exactly what you're paying for. Now, when was the last time you went into the doctor or the hospital or anything in organized medicine and saw a price list? You just don't see one. Well, you see one at MinuteClinic. In fact, that was sort of another aha minute for me. I saw the menu walking into MinuteClinic and the services and the prices, and it's sort of like that Pong thing. It kind of reminded me of something, and then I was amazed when I found out that Michael Howe, the CEO of MinuteClinic, his previous engagement was CEO of Arby's, fast food. I mean, this is fast food meets healthcare, and there's the menu list, and there's the prices. But the retail movement is going to have a profound effect, and in fact, it's going to change the fundamentals of primary care. Believe me, I'm a family physician. My family practice colleagues, internists, pediatricians, they are scared to death of this. They're going crazy over it. You know, the AMA and the American Academy of Pediatrics, they're doing everything they can to stamp this out and regulate it and do something, but it will be a failed mission because these folks that are bringing you retail medicine are bringing you exactly what consumers, exactly what the market wants. Lower cost, higher convenience, electronic medical records, high tech all the way, customer relationship management, they've got it all. And the rest of healthcare is going to have to adjust. Well, one of the other things about the retail health movement is that they make extensive use of nurse practitioners, of course. So primary care is being delivered by the nurse practitioner. But this portends a broader trend. And in fact, if we're going to commoditize medical services, will we end up commoditizing the providers themselves? Yes, I think we may. And it struck me as I was laying on the table several months ago, getting my every 5-year colonoscopy. Fortunately, we're not talking about this at mealtime. It struck me as I was just about to go under the conscious sedation and talking to my former colleague at Virginia Mason, a board-certified gastroenterologist who'd had 12 years of postgraduate training and was doing this procedure all day long. And I really thought, did this guy really need to go to school for 12 years to do this procedure all day long? I think not. And so I think one of the things we're going to see, and the effect is this, if in fact we start, because of labor shortage, because of commoditization, of trying to meet a price point, if we start commoditizing services and commoditizing providers, and if primary care moves into the domain of the nurse practitioner, will then primary care providers start reaching into the specialty and start commoditizing some of those things? Yes, I think indeed that will happen. The fourth trend is information everywhere. I have a saying, and this dawned on me as I was caring for patients in family practice, and the internet came along. And I came up with paternalism in healthcare died a not-so-quiet death with the dawn of the internet. Meaning that when I realized that my patients had 24/7 to study their disease and the world's medical literature at their fingertips, and I was a primary care provider, in very quick order, my patients were coming in as knowledgeable, if not more knowledgeable, than I was. Not with the same context, obviously. Not saying that, you know, it's an equal thing here. But certainly when it came to best practices, latest drugs, clinical trials, I mean, it really fundamentally has forever changed the physician-patient relationship. And as we move forward and new systems come online and you are exposed to price transparency, quality transparency, it fundamentally forever changes everything. And finally, globalization. One of the things that I do at Microsoft, we have an executive briefing center in Redmond. People come from all over the world. And it's one of the great pleasures of my job to sit across the table from prime ministers and ministers of health from Singapore and Thailand and China and India and all kinds of other places. And I've often kind of kidded my American colleagues and said, you know, these people come, they present to us, we tell them about what we're doing, they look at our product roadmap, they show us the digital nirvanas they're building in their countries, the beautiful facilities they're building, and the best of everything. And I say, you know, I can see this glint in their eye. And that glint in their eye is, America, we're going to eat your lunch in healthcare just like we're eating your lunch in everything else, including automobiles and electronics. Very interesting, I was at a conference here in D.C. just last weekend, the Consumer Drug and Healthcare Conference. On the exhibit floor, not one, but half a dozen booths from Thailand, Singapore, Guatemala, Panama, India, China. Furthermore, a number of booths from travel companies specializing in recruiting Americans for treatment in these centers. I went to a presentation by Bangkok Hospital Group. I mean, they showed us hospitals and equipment that would make any American CEO, hospital CEO, green with envy. Facilities we could hardly imagine here in America that they are building. The Arab Emirates also building vast centers expressly to recruit people from all over the world for high quality, much lower cost procedures. It opens markets. It creates competition, and here in America, we'll be challenged to keep up. Okay, so those are the five trends. Now, since I am a visual person, let me share with you a video that will illustrate those trends in action and where we believe healthcare is moving. Now, what's interesting about this video is, I should tell you, we do one of these probably every 3 or 4 years. I've been involved in three of these now with Microsoft, one before I joined the company, two since I've joined. If I showed you the video that we did, which was very futuristic, 7 or 8 years ago, you would look at it and go, well, yeah, that's kind of the way things are. I mean, we showed tablet PCs before there was any such thing, smartphones, before anybody knew what a smartphone was. The reason I mention that is, in this video, you're going to see some things that you're going to go, oh, well, that's so far out there, you know. But what I want you to understand is everything we will show you in this video is either IT technology that I could sell you today or is in the labs at Microsoft Research at this very moment. Furthermore, I'll tell you that actually one of the technologies that was in the labs at Microsoft Research, in the short time it took us to shoot this video, it actually went out the door and is now a commercial product, so be watching for that. I also know that there's so much going on in this video that if I don't tell you what you're going to see, that a lot of it kind of goes over people's heads. So let me share with you what you're going to see, and then we'll show it. First, The scene starts out with a young woman. She's young, she's thin, but she is pre-diabetic. She has a family risk factor here, and she's out trying really hard to take care of herself. She's out running. She's hooked up to some physiological monitors as she runs, or the clothes that she's wearing. They're connecting to her Bluetooth cellular phone and sending information up into the cloud. Because she's granted permission, her case manager is actually looking at this data. And as he looks at it, he realizes that she may be a very good candidate for a clinical trial that he's become aware of. So he sends her a message when she gets home to go online with him and explains to her about this clinical trial and suggests that it's something that she might want to get involved in. But in order to get involved, you know, physicians are still in control here. She has to check with her doctor. And she makes arrangements to do that. The scene will then switch to her doctor, an endocrinologist, beginning his morning rounds in a large hospital. He'll pull out a very sleek-looking tablet PC a couple generations beyond what we have today. It'll guide him through, actually help him navigate and find his patients in the hospital, among other things. The scene will then switch to one of his patients, an elderly gentleman who has diabetes. He's hospitalized. You'll see some use of some new technology, some new ways of thinking perhaps about medication management in the hospital. The doctor then, back to the endocrinologist, he's looking for a retinoscope, a piece of equipment to look in the fundi, the eye grounds of the patient that he's about to see, a little RFID tagging, some things going on here to help him find that piece of equipment. Next, he'll go up to that gentleman with diabetes, and he'll do a fundoscopic exam in real time. They'll share and look at the digital images. He'll compare previous images and talk to his patient about what's going on. Then he's going to walk to another area of the hospital, go into a special room. Note what happens as he walks into this room and fires up his tablet PC. You'll see the glass go opaque to give him some privacy. And he'll enter into a virtual consultation with that same young patient, young woman that we saw earlier who was out jogging. She's now home, and she's having a virtual consultation with her doctor and a clinical researcher about this clinical trial. And you'll see a demonstration of new ways of interacting with data. And finally, the patient is instructed to go, not to her doctor, but to the retail clinic, where she will get some blood tests and pick up some medication for the clinical trial. So that being said, let me show you the video. And be watching for all of that, and see if you can figure out which technology has now gone mainstream over the short period of time this video was made. Thank you. Okay, now we'll do one of those PC Mac commercials. My video worked, Mac. I just couldn't resist. All right. The five trends. What's more important, the five trends, are the impact of those trends. Rising consumerism and the industry's response to that, cost and quality transparency, we're seeing evidence of that already, new service locations, delivery models, leaner operations, always leaner in healthcare, enabling technologies, knowledge-driven insight to information, advanced communication collaboration, and yes, global competition. That's extremely, extremely real. If it can be done virtually, it will. And let me tell you, there's a lot of medicine that can be done virtually. So, bottom line, and that's what most of you care about, is healthcare is becoming and will be more consumer-centric. And you will pay a price in your pocketbook for that. That's part of the reason that's driving this. So let me tell you a little about the role we play as a global technology company and a little bit about our vision and some of the services we are bringing to market for this new arena. We believe profoundly, I mean, we're not a healthcare company, even though since I joined the company 6 years ago, our little healthcare group has grown from about 30 people to more than 800 around the world, including probably a couple of dozen doctors who now are working at Microsoft, so that's different. But we are a software company, we are a platform company, but we believe that in this bridge between providers and consumers, that the web, the software, the applications and service providers play a very, very critical role. On October 4th, as I was jumping on an airplane heading for Japan, my colleague Peter Neupert was here in Washington, D.C., announcing the launch of something we call Health Vault. Health Vault is based on the premise, first and foremost, that if it's going to be health information, it's going to be your information, it's going to be private, and it's going to be secure. It's going to be inclusive of industry standards, and more importantly, because after all, you're consumers, and consumers always like things that are free, it is going to be free for users and developers. Health Vault can be found at www.healthvault.com, easy enough to remember. And basically, I don't know what's going on with the audio here. Basically, it offers three things. Health Vault Search, your Health Vault account, where you can actually store your health information, and the Health Vault Connection Center. One of the things I want to make clear, because the newspapers and the media kind of got this all wrong, there were headlines that said, Microsoft announces personal health record. Nope, that's not what we did. What we announced was a platform upon which people who wish to provide personal health records and a range of other services can play. You might think of it almost as an operating system for healthcare. You might, to use that ATM example, think of it as a platform that's the superhighway of information. That's a better example than saying that what we launched was, in fact, a personal health record. But it is a place where today, and it's very rudimentary. In fact, it's a lot like those old ATMs of past. You know, when ATMs first came to market, you could go up to them and you could check your balance, but that's about all you could do. And quite frankly, most people were still in talking to the teller. But when they became transactional, when you could start to do things, when you could act on things, when there were services, when you could get money out, suddenly ATMs became very, very popular. The same thing will go on here. Today, you know, we're asking you to jump through some hoops. You establish an account, you can upload information, store information in a whole variety of formats, but that's kind of what it does. I mean, ideally you want it to whatever doctor you go to, if you have a Health Vault account, you want that information ported over. If you're dealing with your payer, you want that health information and that information ported over as well. We'll get there. But this is, again, keep in mind, it's a platform upon which that can happen. The Health Vault Connection Center is kind of interesting. So you've probably seen, if you've gone to Best Buy or Fry's or whatever you have out here in the D.C. area, or Bethesda, you're starting to see blood pressure monitors and scales and peak flow meters and glucometers and things that are electronic and that allow you to capture information, store information, and upload it to your computer. Well, we've made all of that simpler by working with a variety of partners, including LifeScan and Polar and others, and this is just the beginning. There are many, many more to come.
and made this truly plug and play. So you bring your device home next to your network or to your Bluetooth on your computer, and it just simply works. And that's, we all like that when that happens. We like things to be easy. So that's what the Connection Center does. If you have one of these devices, if you want to track your, you know, for example, you can have a blood pressure monitor, and it will upload your information, and you can share that information with your doctor if you desire. You can participate in a program from the American Heart Association that will give you reminders and other things about it. Just, it's again, it's early stage, but it's clearly the way things are moving. And then finally, Health Vault Search. Actually, most people will begin with Health Vault Search. We've built Health Vault Search into our Windows Live environment. Basically, Health Vault Search is a very specifically targeted health search engine that, you know, instead of just, if you use a generic search engine, you get lots of random stuff. What this does is very specifically exposes you to sort of three channels, if you will. On one side, you're getting highly qualified information from reliable sources, Mayo, National Institutes of Health, Gold Standard, ones like that. In the middle, you'll get some other kind of information to expand your search. You'll also get kind of a dashboard where you can quickly refine your search according to, are you looking for conditions or procedures or nutrition or, you know, what are the interdependencies and relationships? It makes that very easy. And then finally, over on the right side of the screen, you can act on that search. So it's really, it's about discover, learn, act, and you can also save these searches and so forth, and then move on to some of the other services. But what I really want to impart upon you is that basically what we're doing with Health Vault is creating a space, an open space, exposing the APIs, working with industry partners, other technology companies, working with healthcare organizations, health organizations, not-for-profits, for-profits, to provide a range of services and offerings that will take us into this new era. I was asked specifically to end with a few thoughts on how academia, the public sector, research works with private industry, and what are the opportunities. And it's really simply a list. I kind of jotted a few thoughts down this morning about public-private partnerships. One is we need our academic medical centers. We need our training programs to embrace technology. We want you to be thinking as we are about Web 2.0 and Web 3.0. If you go on my blog, and I'll give you the address at the end of this, I was just blown away by a talk yesterday by Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine. He presented his four megatrends, and he talked about the next transformation of the web. And what the web really is, and I don't think many of us don't appreciate it, is it has become the interconnectedness of all devices and all things, and is essentially now the worldwide computer. And the way this is going to transform everything we do and how all products are becoming really services on the web. So think services, not products. Take advantage of I think there are opportunities for academia and research to take advantage of our Health Vault platform and other platforms like this that surely will emerge, because we're certainly not naive or crazy enough at Microsoft to think that one size fits all or there won't be lots of opportunities on a number of platforms for this kind of thing. But I also do believe that it does take a Microsoft, it does take a Google, it does take global technology companies to solve this, because it takes a lot of deep investment and a whole lot of patience to make this work. And I don't mean patience as I think of patience, I mean patience. Leverage the power of our mutual brands. You have a brand. The NIH has a brand. The NCI has a brand. We can leverage the power of our brands. Help us improve health around the world. It's interesting that our vision at Microsoft is not, you know, to make the best software for healthcare or to sell more copies of Windows to healthcare. Our vision, our mission statement is to improve health around the world. And where we come into play is where information technology does that. And the way you can do that is be thinking about how do we speed along clinical trials. Again, you know, I talked about the paper morass in our hospitals and health systems today, but there's a paper morass in clinical research today, and we're losing so much valuable data that way. Educate consumers and providers and think about how do we actually provision care on the web. Our current system is not scalable, and I'll leave you with this thought. 10 years ago, before I joined Microsoft, I was involved in founding a company that got a lot of worldwide press at the time. What we were trying to do was basically create a system so doctors and patients could exchange messaging and email, provide reliable content and services, and even set up a system where people could fluidly schedule an appointment with their doctor and see their doctor without ever leaving their home or office. 10 years ago, the technology was clunky, it was cumbersome, it was burdensome, and the market just wasn't ready for it. What I want to impart on you today is today that technology has become commoditized. Every doctor with a laptop and a $60 web camera is a global medicine, telemedicine, telehealth, personalized telemedicine provider. It's fundamentally changed dynamics. So what we were trying to do 10 years ago is today very easy, commoditized, and low cost. Be thinking about not only how we provision information and services, be thinking about how we provision care in this new era on the net. Use these tools to communicate and collaborate effectively with your peers, your colleagues, and consumers. These are some resources I'd like you to check out. In particular, if you just type my name into any search engine, and you can even, if you want, use that one that starts with G that I don't talk about. Just throw in my name. One of the first things that comes up is Health Blog. If you really want to kind of get inside our head about sort of what I'm observing as I travel around the world, the kinds of things we're thinking about at Microsoft, and more importantly, that what I'm writing about and saying is the reaction on the blog to what I'm writing and saying, it's a great place to do a real quick study of kind of all things and perhaps come up with some great ideas for yourself on transforming healthcare and improving health around the world. So you've been a very attentive audience after a long session. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank the presenters for their insightful and forward-looking glimpses into the future. And I'd like to transition us now to Dr. Steve Taplin, who's a senior scientist in the Applied Research Program. He's going to serve as our discussant today and provide the medical perspective for our panelists. So, Dr. Taplin.
Get my slides up. And one of the unusual realities of working, I don't know if it's a reality, but certainly a reality today, working with the private sector is we are ahead of time. And we actually have 15 extra minutes to work with. So I really look forward to getting to the discussion, and we will do that as soon as I do this. So we're going to talk a little bit about the morning and just a couple of reflections on IT, and the reality that it sort of reminds me of buying a car. You know, last time I bought a car, I did a lot of work. I figured out I needed 4 tires, really good tires. I need a chassis. I need a really good chassis. I need a good box to protect the people that are riding in the car. And then I need it to collapse when the car gets hit. And then I need it, so I get good engine. I want a good warranty. And I look a little bit more around, and maybe I want a little bit of pizzazz. Then I go in and walk into the lot to buy the car, and the guy comes up to me and says, "Have I got a GPS system for you?" And all of a sudden, you're in a different world, because he's telling you all the things the GPS system can do. It can find you anywhere you are. It can virtually show you the next turn. It can do all these things. And I'm saying, "But what about my tires? What about my tires?" And so we have this problem that we need to understand what we want, and we need to be pretty clear about that if we're going to actually get what we want, because there's a whole other agenda out there, and there's a whole other set of things going on. So who is it anyway? And part of it is people in general, and we've heard about that a little bit, and part of it is physicians, and part of it is insurance and financial personnel. But in fact, I'm not too worried about that part of it. The financial and insurance personnel have been in charge of doing information systems, and they manage money, and money moves, and money's always been able to move, and I'm not so worried about that. But I am worried about how do people in general and physicians and healthcare personnel get what they want. And the truth is, we actually don't know what we want. The truth is, we know what was. We know how we delivered healthcare with paper, and 80% of us are doing it already now. We know that we write things down. We know we want to track. And I actually spent the last 20 years taking care of people, and the last 5 years in HRSA, figuring out what exactly it is we want to do in cancer to translate cancer control into practice. And it was really, I really broke it down pretty simply now into, I want to be able to track individual and have the salient data, not all the data, the salient data in front of me when I see that patient. I want to be able to aggregate that and measure what's actually happening with all the people in general on average. And then I want measures. I want information back to me that tells me who's in, who's following the rules, who's not, what do I, and give me a tool to make that better. So I'm pretty clear about what I want, but in fact, you heard this morning, there's a whole lot more out there that we can do. And so the question is, what is it we're really trying to achieve? And our goal is to provide the environment, and my assumption is that our goal is to provide the environment in which individuals can optimize their health. And I think we heard that this morning already. That's ultimately the goal. That's where you're going to make money if you're doing that well. And so how does the e-world contribute to that goal? Well, most of us, as you've already heard, an individual living out in the community spends 99.9998% of their time outside the doctor's office. So you got to figure out, and they are working on that, how do you support people when they're outside the doctor's office? How do you link people? How do you find information? And so what happens in the doctor's office is a small part of what's going to happen in the future. We need to think about how we get information, and people are already doing information well, but we're here today, and we saw in the vision that Dr. Crowns presented, there are ways now that we're going to be able to support network and support people in the community that are going to greatly help what we can do in the future. But eventually, people have to leave the community and come down and pass through the layers of the healthcare system and actually end up in somebody's practice. And when somebody begins to move through the layers of the healthcare system and move into practice, things get a lot more complicated because they need to move through steps in the process of care from being somebody now just out there at risk to somebody who needs to be screened or taken care of, somebody who needs to get a diagnosis, somebody who may need to actually get treatment, somebody who maybe needs to be monitored over time and eventually return back into the community. And we heard this morning that people are concerned about when they return. I'm concerned about how do they get in. Both ends of the spectrum, getting in and getting out, are complicated paths. And so there's a whole bit of management and a whole bit of healthcare which is about the transitions between these points in the healthcare system, how we get people in, how we get people move people through, and how we get people back out. And it's that whole process, it's summarizing that whole process called the cancer care continuum that really achieves the goal that we're after, which is improving health in the country. You've got to get people through that entire continuum of care and link up all of those steps in care to help us achieve things. And right now, when a patient comes into that continuum, begins to enter into that, the patient moves across the continuum and links providers after multiple providers. In fact, what we have is patient care, centered care by default, because the most stressed and the least medically informed person in the process becomes the unifying force, or not. They're the one that have to actually integrate the messages from each of us as physicians and make some sense out of it. And they're not part of the other discussion that's going on, which is doctors talking to each other as they pass persons across that continuum of care. So we need to be thinking about a way that we move out of that problem, because it's actually more complicated than I presented it, because in fact we've got families and staff talking to each other and then multiple links of communication. You can make a mess very fast, and all of us, if you've been a patient, you've been in the middle of it. If you've been a doctor, you've been in the middle of it. You've seen what happened. And so we need to begin to think about how we move out of that system into a system in which a patient actually has a single source of care. And in fact, I put this together without really thinking much about the vault, but the vault is a good example, though I'm sure there are alternatives to that. But the point is to have a single point where all of us begin to communicate, and the patient moves through that process pivoting around a single source of information. And so e-technology offers us some hope. For creating new ways for gathering information, for pursuing health in the community, for linking care within the course of care, and I think we also need to be thinking about linking care across the layers of the healthcare system so that we're not recreating information across practices and across layers of the healthcare system. We're actually understanding each other and using the same source of information. And it's all of that's going to lead to the outcome that we're seeing, which is improved health. So e-technology will help, but only if. And I want you to recall buying a car. How do we make sure we get what we want and what we need? Realizing that, in fact, we're not sure what we want. We actually don't know for sure what we want. We need to engage in a process of discussion and discovery with the general population, with providers and healthcare personnel. Because if you think back about the car, In fact, the GPS is a great tool. GPS is a great tool. I just didn't think about it. I was worried about wheels and chassis and other things. You walk in, and in fact, the GPS is a great tool. It will help me get where I want to go, better than the person I'm riding with. And when I miss the turn, I don't hear, "Wait, you missed the turn again." It says, "Recalculating." So it actually has a way to help and make life better if you begin to think about how to use it. So we need real information about what our needs are, what providers' needs are, and what patients' needs are. And we've already heard providers, 26% are using the healthcare system. 32% do not currently use and have no interest in the information system. So, and what do we know about people in general? I think you heard more about it than I have got here, and certainly 50% of people went to the internet first to get healthcare. 50% want to go to their provider. But in fact, it's not about the technology. I think what I take home from this presentation is the technology is going to be able to do whatever we want. The question is, what do we want? We need to know about what these people want, and we need to know what we want, and we need to know what it could be. What can we do? What can it provide? How can it actually help us realize the kind of care we actually want to deliver? And so we have to listen carefully. So we need an interactive development process. It's not going to happen the first time. I almost guarantee you it's not going to happen the first time. First time, it's going to be wrong. We need a process in which we can change and recreate what we're doing all the way along the way to allow iterations that help us realize what could be and to achieve the goal of optimizing health for all Americans. We need an interactive process. So I want to turn first to the panel and ask, what in fact is the process? How do we begin to put in place a process? And what is the motivation for putting in place a process which will help us realize this potential, that will take into account what people want and what providers want, and will not end up with designing a IT system which, in fact, does not deliver what we need?
You want me to start?
Sure.
You're just putting me after the wolves. I just commented that only in D.C. will this question get asked. See, we have this thing called the free market, and when you buy cars, the free market has been used for a long time to figure out which assemblage of tools work for whom. Something very similar is going to happen in healthcare. Different people want different things. There is no we. People are complex and distributed and heterogeneous. And what you end up figuring out is for example, my dad is old and needs full-time care. His needs are totally different than mine, which are totally different, again, than my son, who's a healthy 25-year-old and fearless doing a startup in Beijing. You can't say what we need. You know, my son's purchasing decisions in terms of how he interacts with his health care are going to be different than mine, and mine are going to be different again than my dad's. And that's just one random sample. So I don't think we need a top-down system to figure out what we need. What we need is a system where people can go out and buy what they want. And then the market will very quickly figure out which things actually meet needs and which things don't.
So I understand what you're saying. Explain a little bit more about how you do an IT process in which, in fact, the flexibility is there to allow the individuals to end up with what exactly they need, so that the father and the son can all get to what they need, as opposed to
I like to pitch in a little, because I'm a little older than Adam, so I see things a little differently perhaps.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure. First of all, I agree that the market should be able to figure this out. But I'd also like to point out that one of the things that we're suffering from in America, sadly, is 40 years of entitlement mentality. When I first entered the workforce, and this was in a union town in Toledo, Ohio, not working in healthcare at the time, and my health insurance at that time meant major hospitalization covered at 80%. All of my outpatient work, lab, x-rays, even maternity in those days was a non-covered service. Now, what happened over 40 years? Unions, lobbyists, and everybody else under the sun created a system. In fact, where I live in Seattle, my health insurance has to include chiropractic, nutritionist, massage therapy, acupuncture, so on and so forth. So here's what we've created, and I use this analogy with graduate students. Here's my challenge to you. We're going to stay on the automobile theme. In this theme, everybody in America
is going to get to drive a shiny new red Ferrari. Now, your challenge is to come up with an insurance program that insures shiny red Ferraris. This program must cover all oil changes, parts, labor, everything for that Ferrari over its lifetime. Oh, and by the way, all Ferraris get totaled. Now, come up with an affordable plan to pay for everybody in America to drive the red Ferrari. My point is that healthcare always gets rationed, always has been, always will be. Countries ration it differently. We need to have a real serious discussion here in America about issues around quality of life, end of life, what public dollars should be spent for, what private dollars should be spent for. And until we fundamentally address that issue, we're going to keep coming back to the same old place. Because what consumers would want is that all cars be free. In the real world, that doesn't work.
Well, I think one of the answers to your question, though, about how does IT do this, is you need to separate two different things. What Microsoft has done with HealthVault, or what I hope my alma mater does with Google Health, is create a place into which everyone else can plug in. And all it is the ATM network. It's simply a shared place for exchanging medical data and storing it. That, in some sense, is just an enabler. It's a critical enabler, but it's an enabler. At that point, honestly, the rest of what IT does is it decides who is the we it cares about. You know, Porsche doesn't go after the same customer as Hyundai. And Ford doesn't go, I don't know who Ford goes after, but some people drive BMWs and they want that sort of instant feel on the road, and other people drive Lexus because they want that sort of total quiet and comfort. And different people go after different things. A good way to think about, just a very simple way to think about people's health needs, is you can separate people into a 2x2 matrix, the worried and the unworried, and the sick and the healthy. And are you worried about the worried healthy, sort of the baby boomer generation? Are you worried about the unworried sick, sort of the poor people with diabetes or high obesity who aren't even thinking about it? Are you worried about the unworried sick, who are basically the kids who just want exercise programs? Are you worried about the worried sick who are living in the hospitals? And then within that, you have different areas of specialization. I don't think IT ever should try to solve all problems for all people, is my answer to you. They should simply have a framework into which they can plug so that as people migrate from one need to another, their data moves with them. And as long as there are tools, and I applaud Microsoft for doing HealthVault like that, you know, I think the rest of us can just plug our IT solutions in. And you know, the one sine qua non is sharing the data. The second one would be communication, but the web has become very good at communication. Every demo we saw, I have to say, I suffered from PowerPoint envy in a big way in this presentation, but I don't like PowerPoint, so I eschew it. Even when I was at Microsoft, I didn't use it to present the bill, so at least I'm consistent. But, you know, the web is already very good at helping people communicate, and, you know, on the PC versus Mac issue, if you have a Mac, you don't even need the webcam. It's built in. So, you know, you're guaranteed to be able to communicate. The one issue we need to be able to have your information at your fingertips, your medical information, be able to share it. And then different IT vendors will come up with different solutions, and people will pick the tools that they use to meet their needs, either as people who are ill or as caregivers for people who are ill. And one last point, you know, there was a lot of focus on how elderly people, particularly when 80 plus, are not as computer literate or not as motivated to use the web. That's true. But it's true of everything to do with the web. And what happens is you have the equivalent of caregivers. There's some family member, typically, or friend, who steps up to help them. And so in some sense, when you're designing these IT systems, you're actually not designing them for the people who are not able to use an IT system. You're designing them for the caregivers at that point. And that's a different bar. That's my end user bar, not my I can't use the computer bar.
Great. Vern, you want to comment? You had a pretty interesting development process when you were talking about the development swing, but looked at really intensively looking at particular markets and particular people.
Right. So I think there the ethnography really makes a difference in understanding end users. Steve, I think you're raising a very good point, though, about the role of government agencies. And I think clearly where the market sometimes fails is when you have problems with Free Rider, Tragedy of the Commons, and so forth. Some of what we're talking about here perhaps could be fostered or accelerated by the government providing some incentives, a safe harbor, a safe incubation, or whatever. I imagine that's where perhaps you're driving, and we'd love to hear some more about such efforts here at NIH around that.
Well, I think this is a start of a conversation in which we want to begin to engage in how do we provide information about what exactly is going on and what exactly we want to do. So we also want to entertain questions from the audience as a whole. Are there questions out there at this point for these three speakers? John Kerner, you want to talk?
Adam, how about the folks that ride the bus who have no option to purchase a car? Does your system that you're sort of articulating, the marketplace, actually provide the we who are perhaps I would call what you referred to as the unworried and unwell in your 2x2 matrix, will the system be able to provide for, and these new technologies really provide for the sort of those populations that bear the greatest burden of cancer and many other chronic diseases? And if it won't, because often new technologies do tend to exacerbate disparities, how can we in government work with the private sector to try and sort of smooth the way or find some way to level the field so that more populations who never get a chance to buy a car but will always be riding the bus can benefit from some of the tools and toys you all are developing?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, honestly, the number of people who have to ride the bus is actually very large if you look at the cost of caring for people as they get older. Having lived with this myself, having to care for a parent 24/7, you can be very comfortable and still be daunted by the expenses involved in that. So I think more and more people are going to face a situation in which no matter how well you're doing, effectively you're starting to ride the bus. I think there are three ways we need to address this problem. One of them, which is probably the most obvious one, is to figure out how to reduce the costs. We are spending $2 trillion a year in healthcare right now in the U.S. We're on track to spend $4 trillion within less than 15 years, which would be 30-some percent of our GDP, or as much as we spend in the federal budget. Clearly, that's not sustainable. And just figuring out how to lower the cost dramatically, I think, is one of the key issues. Because otherwise, we'll all be riding the bus, and it will be a pretty grim bus at that. I think that is one of the key issues here. And certainly when I've been looking at it, and I think some of these presentations were, how do we help patients start to take charge of their destiny in more cost-effective ways? MinuteClinic's a good example of doing something cheaper. The second answer to how do we do this is indeed government entitlement. I think the comment about rationing was a totally valid one. I personally don't know what the right answers are. I've spent a lot of time talking to Michael Porter and Elizabeth Tyker's group about sort of their view on how you manage health care, reading different books, watching Michael Moore's movie for a different theme. What I do know is a system where people have a short-term view of the people they care for is working less well than almost any other system because it's the most expensive possible solution. If you look at the system we have today, we have a very expensive system in the sense that people try very hard not to give you entitlement, and probably 15 to 20% of that $2 trillion goes in trying to avoid coverage. And then we have a system where we don't treat people well, keep people healthy so they get sick, and then we see the numbers we just saw up on the board where they run $10,000-$12,000 a year, and probably, I don't know the exact numbers, I've actually been asking for some help, but call it $600 to $800 billion a year of that $2 trillion goes into that. Well, $100 trillion here, $100 million here, soon you're talking real money. So, even by D.C. standards. So, I do think a second issue is to figure out how do we focus the system on people being healthy rather than getting sick in the first place. But we will still have an entitlement system. I'm not trying to propose that we don't, and I think government has a role there. What I'm saying is that if governments focus very much entirely right now on trying to make sure that people have the right to their data electronically, or put differently, that every time I have any encounter with anyone that has a wellness implication, I have the right to go and ask for that data to be transported into his vault or equivalent systems, and nothing else. Anytime I had a lab test done, anytime I picked up drugs, anytime I saw a massage therapist, anytime I did any of these things, I could say, this is my data and I have a right to it. That would already be an enormous enabler for all of us, no matter how poor or how sick. And that won't cost government very much money, you know, whereas a lot of the other things are going to cost a fortune. I mean, the government did a wonderful thing a while ago when they gave everyone the right to have dialysis. It's now $30 billion a year industry. But the question you have to ask is, most of that dialysis is avoidable. Wouldn't it be more wonderful still if the government made sure that we didn't need to spend that $30 billion a year because people didn't need to be on dialysis because they didn't have renal failure when they got diabetes? And I guess my bus answer is not to deny the right of government or the role of government in entitlement, because I think that's critical. You know, I'm the same way that I sent my kids to public school when they were growing up. But more to say, to the degree that which we can cut the cost and add efficiency into the system, the government will have a lot more money to spend, and the bus fleet will be better fleet.
Bill? I'd like to add to that thought what Dr. Shen brought up, which is, of course, moving health care away from acute care into the home and prevention and all those things we talk about. But more importantly, something that we as citizens can all do, because government is a big player. It's 60% of the dollars in the system. And yet government has, and private industry as well, has all kinds of crazy rules that are preventing us from getting where we need to be. I mean, why is it that in 2007 that the only way I as a physician can give you anything is to make you physically to come into my office? And people say, I want to do email with my doctor, I want virtual visits, I want this, I want that. Well, you can't blame your doctor for not going there when nobody wants to pay him for doing that. But wouldn't it make sense for Medicare and Medicaid and private industry to pay doctors for doing email and make what would have been a $300 visit a $20 visit instead? I mean, some of this just, it defies logic why we're not thinking more creatively about the way we provision care in 2007.
I'd build on that, say, if you look at things like David Kindig's Institute of Medicine report on health illiteracy a few years back, it was mentioned earlier this morning as well. I think that we need to have both health literacy and health policy literacy for the citizens. This being D.C., we can't not talk about politics, I guess, especially in a run-up to an election year. I think we need to shift the discourse from easy labels to really trying to ask some of the harder questions. And I know it's difficult for people in government to do that in your public role, but I think at least educating the citizens to see what the issues, problems, and potential solutions are would be really key.
One last small point, and those were great points that you made. CMS has an amazing amount of data about how many procedures are done by which hospitals and what the outcomes are. One of the most basic principles is if you want to improve people's access to something, give them more data about price and performance. And yet that data is not publicly available. You know, I can't electronically walk up to CMS, download that data, and then put up a nice Google map showing which hospitals have which numbers in which neighborhoods. Government could obviously do that, and something as simple as taking the data the government does have and making that data available to all would all by itself be a huge advantage.
Question. Can you please just identify yourself too so we can...
Pardon me?
Can you just identify yourself as you come up?
Sure. Hi, Richard Singerman, currently with IBM's healthcare practice and formerly with Dr. Braylor's shop over at the HHS. For those healthcare systems that already have the long-term incentive, the Kaisers, the VAs, I was wondering maybe if you could comment on lessons you're learning there as the rest of the economy has to kind of figure out how to get the right incentives, but they already have the long-term incentive.
You know, it's too bad that my buddy Ted Eaton, who was here earlier, one of the IT leader at a group called Cooperative of Puget Sound, where I live. Very interesting. I spent with Dr. Taplin a few years working in the medical director's office at Group Health Cooperative, which, like Kaiser, is a staff model managed care organization, which serves as both payer and provider. And in fact, as I look around the country for best examples of best practices in using IT in healthcare, it's perhaps no surprise that it is those organizations. In fact, Steve is aware of, I have a list that I often show my audiences of sort of best e-health practices, and in a large audience of providers will say, how many of you are doing all this? And very few hands will go up. But the fact of the matter is that Group Health, Kaiser, UPMC, that are both payer and provider, they're doing all of it. I mean, it's prescriptions online, email with your doctor, your complete medical record online, et cetera. Now, why is that happening? Well, because these organizations are both payer and provider. They win by provisioning care and the most appropriate level of care exactly when and where it's needed. When a patient crosses the physical threshold, the physical boundary of the institution, the bricks and mortars, they start consuming personnel, equipment, stuff. A simple thing becomes a very expensive thing. These organizations have learned that if an email or a message or a lesser skilled worker or a nurse practitioner or some, in other words, they give you just the most appropriate level of care when and where it's needed. And the doctors there do get reimbursed for doing email and messaging and all of this. So I think there's a lesson to be learned for all of healthcare and for government as well in that.
I had the same three in mind, UPMC, Group Health, and Kaiser, because they are indeed role models for where the system works. And the reason is simple. They're focused on the overall cost of, during your lifetime, and they know prevention is cheaper than cure, and they know that doing it outside the office is better than doing it inside when possible. So they have pioneered. The new PHRs have kind of Kaiser, for example, in the last couple of years, isn't it? A great example of how the system should work.
Another question here.
Yes, my name is Mary Hamill Parker. NIH is part of a larger Department of Health and Human Services, and the Department of Health and Human Services funds programs for children and older people through social services networks. And as a member of the Commission on Aging in Alexandria, Virginia, I'd like to suggest that when you think about IT for health, you also think about IT for social services, because those agencies do not have funds to develop the interaction and the record keeping that interfaces with the personal health care records.
Nor should they, because we should be able to provision the tools and services, and particularly in a web services environment that will, you know, so you're not having to write code, develop tools.
But it's the connectivity that's the problem often, and their ability to interface their existing record systems with what you all provide.
I think you're also getting at not only technological connectivity, but also social connectivity, and the fact that social services so often address the other needs that I mentioned briefly, housing, food, ride sharing, all sorts of things that those of us who actually have to take care of dependents deal with in a very practical sense.
I'll also add that we have a new director at Microsoft who is the managing director for health and social services, so it's an area that we're focusing on very intently.
Other comments from the group? The question here, whether within the panel, the presentations that you saw of each other raise questions that you like to ask of each other at this point. You come and talk and give an opportunity to interact with the community. I'm just asking whether you have specific questions that are raised by the directions of the other panel presenters that you'd like to raise.
I've got to ask Bill which of those technologies became real during the shooting of the video.
Oh, I forgot to tell you. Does anybody know? Well, the technology became what is it? No, that existed years ago, but it's still cool. No, actually, it's called surface computing, and very interesting. Surface computing is a sort of a tabletop device that allows you to manually, digitally interact with stuff. And what's interesting about it is that its first foray commercially is in, you might guess, casinos, retail, hospitality, restaurants, that sort of thing. Now, what's interesting is since that technology got launched, I have been flooded by inquiries from healthcare companies, healthcare IT companies, industry solution vendors. Everybody looks at this and goes, oh my God, I can think of a million ways we can use this in healthcare. Unfortunately, the team that worked on this is so consumed right now just delivering it to casinos that healthcare is kind of down the list on their agenda, but we'll get there, and it is going to indeed be exciting.
I've seen it, and it's very cool, but I would argue the first massive consumer use of surface technology was called the iPhone.
And you know what? I love the iPhone because it is absolutely stirring the whole industry to create
It immediately makes you expect surface technology when done
in
a large.
I'm Elliot Siegel, National Library of Medicine. I'm a little concerned about the Ferrari analogy. I like to think that we probably can solve all the problems of the healthcare delivery system here at NIH. But where we can perhaps create that Ferrari is creating the very best health information possible and make that accessible on the platforms that, that the private sector can provide. And in that connection, I would ask the question, Andy Grove, when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, wrote very, very, very widely about how the effort he undertook to find the various treatments that were possible, then to personalize those treatments to his own particular cancer and then make a decision. And patients are continually confronted with the need to find the very best information that applies to them. And the standardized systems that we make available from NIH and most other places aren't that customized. What might be on your drawing boards that would be able to mine these data in a way intelligently that that individuals can, in fact, personalize the information on the web to their own particular case?
Well, I think certainly if you take a little tour of Health Vault Search and the search engine, which actually was garnered through an acquisition that Microsoft made from a company called MedStory, which was founded by a physician who spent his whole life working on such things, that will give you an example of where we can go. Now, it's certainly not, you know, where we need to be. It doesn't do everything that we would want it to do, but it certainly is making search much better, much more specific, and much more relevant. And I know that my friends at Google are working very hard at this as well. One of the things that strikes me, I mean, kind of growing up in this industry and as a physician, is, you know, it wasn't that many years ago when if you wanted health information, your choice literally was to try to find somebody who was somehow affiliated with a medical library so you could go in and look at stuff, right? I mean, there was no way to get it. I mean, think of how free and ubiquitous information is. So the information is out there. Now we just need to do a better job of making it relevant to people in their searches.
We spoke earlier about shifts in power. I think there's also a shift in the information asymmetry, right? It used to be that your physicians and payers would know more about your disease than you. We may be moving to a point where perhaps you may know more about your disease and health risks and, by the way, utilization patterns than they do. So there might be some interesting shifts in the industry with regard to health reimbursement.
I do think the question that's asked, though, is one of the hardest questions we in the industry face, which is, I mean, for example, I was giving a talk bioinformatics class a few months ago, and a doctor got up very annoyed. I was at Google at the time, and said, I have a patient who has Bell's palsy, and she looked up the prognosis through Google, and the prognosis was 70% that it would not go away. She's first occurrence, 13 years old. This is totally not the right prognosis. How dare you put that information in front of her? And I said, you're right. You know, the problem we have is that we don't know what's sort of the phenotypic information that's germane to each page. And it's very, very difficult to know sort of which pages are phenotypically relevant to whom. In fact, honestly, it's hard enough to know which pages are trustworthy at all. Never mind phenotypically relevant. What I do expect will happen, and this is why I push not only for tools like Health Vault, but also for consistent standards for encoding, is that as we get both tools like Health Vault and consistent standards for encoding, we will have a very large amount of data. Don't think 5 or 10 million, but think 50 to 100 million sets of phenotypic data online. And at that point, our ability to look at groups and see which things have worked for which groups starts to become very, very powerful. So collecting that data is a precursor and a necessary precursor to starting to give people the information they need about which things the people who are in their boat, people like them, are using to good effect, not to mention letting committees like NIH and NCI then look statistically to start reporting, if you will, on the NCI good, you know, seal of housekeeping approval, and yes, these things are statistically valid for this group. And that the precursor, obviously, is to have a very large body of normative phenotypic data, which is why I push on the consistent encoding. But the search problem, you know, by which I mean searching for relevant content, that's a very hard problem. And, you know, I think if the industry makes significant headway on that in the next 10 years, we will have done some very clever things, because it is hard to understand which pages make sense for whom.
Hi, I'm Kim Buteau from the NCI. I'm intrigued but a little confused by the sort of deliberations of the panel, and I'd love to actually get some clarity. Many of us were really, really excited about several years ago when the
the federal government sort of started to go into the process of trying to bring together all these key private stakeholders to organize and launch what was felt to be the necessary e-health revolution in this space. What I think I hear you guys saying is that basically, if I look at Microsoft, if I look at Google and whatever, that the private sector's got this under control at this point. We should just let the market play out. I guess what I'm trying to find out is where or do you see a role for what should the federal government be doing in this space right now to see to it that this happens? Because, again, all of us are big believers in the market sector and unquestionably the power of the market here. And, you know, maybe the right thing for us to do is just get out of the way since these, you know, Clash of the Titans is about to emerge, but in the next couple of years when the dust settles. But I mean, a couple of years would be tremendously rapid progress if in the next 3 to 5 years the act of all of these groups suddenly have the emergent electronic health record. So what roles should the government be doing in this space? Because I think there's some heterogeneity of opinion.
I think I'd be very interested. I think government has a very important role to play. I mean, one is in helping us set standards. I mean, many people use the, you know, the railway gauge or the highway lane analogy, or, you know, the instrumentation in our cars. You have to have some basic standards there, and the government focus on that is important. I think raising national awareness is important. I alluded to the vendor certification process focused on interoperability is important. I think what we should not do, and part of the reason I get kind of frankly bored with the whole NHIN Rio discussion, is that we are trying to boil the ocean and deliver something that probably isn't all that meaningful. I've had many CMOs and CMIOs and CIOs comment to me that, you know, they don't really care that much about getting data from a patient who happens to be visiting from New York when they can't get data from a patient who's in a hospital across the street. And that's really clear. And then when we look at, well, what does the personal health record, what data does it need to contain? I like to think of it as a clinician of, well, what's the minimum subset of data that I need to either initiate care on a patient I've never seen or perhaps make a referral? Well, really, that's a little bit of demographic information. I want to know who's going to pay me, if anybody. I want a medication list, a problem list, and maybe some allergies. That's about all. I don't need every piece of data that ever was generated on you in any place, any time. At least not now. Someday maybe. But I see so much process going around, so much agony over standards and design of these things that are so bloated and boil the ocean kinds of things that we'll never get there. That's my concern.
I think another potential role for government is in training and in the early careers of people going into informatics. I think if we look at the EIS from CDC, is there an equivalent of a public health informatics service that we could actually create for people who are earlier in their careers? Things like the National Library of Medicine's 10x10 initiative are terrific, but to take it beyond that and sort of say how do you get launched in a career might be really interesting.
I think there are a couple of things that the government should not do and three things that the government should do. The NHIN discussion is interesting. 2 years ago, the Markle Foundation introduced me to this. And honestly, I spent the last 2 years arguing that this was a bad idea. And I was just at a meeting of the Markle Foundation where they put up their new architecture, and I breathed this huge sigh of relief because for the first time I saw patient-centered and customer-centered architecture as opposed to a Rio-centered architecture. And I believe that this was the right thing to do. In general, while I think there's a role for railroad ties, I think it's very circumscribed. If the government would simply take, as I said before, the encodings for meds, the encodings for procedures, and the encodings for allergies, and put those in the public domain with an unlimited license for all, with associated text, I'd be thrilled and say that's our railroad stake. Now, you know, let's go make automation happen. In the second thing that scares me, and this is the thing that, in terms of government not doing something, there's a lot of talk going on these days about putting in privacy regulations for personal PHRs. It's very much as though the government could go into my closet, look at the data that I've assembled about myself, and tell me exactly how I can use it and what rights I have to it, and then tell people they're forbidden to give me that information in the first place. Frankly, it's very frightening. It will stillborn an industry that otherwise has enormous potential for us all. And I would like to not see the government do that.
You know, one person at the Markle Foundation said very pointedly, you know, many, many people die every day from a lack of information. Virtually no one has died from an accidental disclosure of information. And we need to keep that in mind. And, you know, watching my mother when she was ill with ovarian cancer, while privacy was an issue, frankly, normally what the real issue was getting the right advice and care. And she gave up a certain amount of privacy for that. So what are other things I'd like to see government do? Number one, I would like to see government do what government does best, which is make sure that people have rights. In this case, it's the rights to their data. I should be able to go to my insurance company and say, send me my data electronically. I can't do that. I can't walk up there, and when you go to them, they go, oh, well, maybe we'll give you a PHR. I don't want their PHR. I want my data. They say, oh, we're doing AHIP. We'll share data between ourselves. I don't want AHIP. I want my data. You know, just having the right to go to the insurance companies and say, give me my data, to me, is a very basic right. To go to anyone who is automated, go to Epics, the Cerners, whatever, and say, if you're going to keep data about patients, give them the right to get that data electronically. That is your requirement. Believe me, Epic and Cerner and all those people are quite capable of implementing that. They just don't want to. So, give, you know, that would be the number one right thing I'd like to see government do. It doesn't cost a lot. It just says people have a right to their data. The second thing that I think government should do is the one I just said. They should describe the encodings and make them free. For example, this has happened with SNOMED codes internationally. And because of that, you know, industry is rapidly looking at how can we gravitate to this. Kaiser is interesting because Kaiser, since they are both an insurer and a payer, doesn't need CPT codes. They don't need fancy ways to figure out how to bill the insurer when they are the insurer. And so they don't use them. They use SNOMED codes. And where the SNOMED codes didn't cover the procedures, they went and invented their own, and they would happily give those back to the public domain. You know, looking at government's role, maybe take that, work with Kaiser, and come up with a free standard-based way to describe clinically interesting events as opposed to billable events. Would be a really useful role for government, you know, one that I think would help us all. And then the third thing that I think government should do is the government should figure out how to give people a cut on their costs. This is the single biggest thing that's been shown to motivate differences in behavior or behavior modification, a cut in their health costs if people are shown to adhere to programs that are actually improving their healthiness. I mean, as I said earlier, you know, whether we're paying $400 billion, $500 billion, $600 billion, $800 billion, we're paying some enormous premium for people not being healthy. Government could very well afford to provide a cut to people on their insurance rates if, in fact, they showed that they were living healthier lives. And I think government should start to try and change to reward people for being healthy rather than paying for the physicians when people get sick.
And I would add that employers have a major role to play here, too, considering how people who do have health insurance receive it in this country.
I'd like to actually expand on that question that Ken just posed, because these are great recommendations. A lot of them are out of NIH's purview, believe it or not, because they're regulatory, they're policy-oriented, which is exactly what you would think. But one thing NIH does, and it's one thing the National Science Foundation does, is another role of government, is that we can incentivize research in sort of high-risk areas, but areas that you can then build on. So there's a good colleague of mine, Larry Brandt, over at the National Science Foundation. He's proud of the fact that he gave a little sugar grant, you know, $100,000, to Mark Andreessen. And that's launched, it's helped launch a lot of this revolution, everything from the Sputnik generation. If you were to look at some of the kind of high-risk research in behavior, in consumer behavior, using these technologies, that government can help you folks with, what would that be?
I think this is actually something that we've thought about at Intel a fair bit, because there's a lot of attention being paid to biological markers of disease, genomics, proteomics, and so forth. But there's a relatively understudied area of behavioral markers of disease, whether it's tremor, gait, voice, eye gaze, social interaction. And I sort of alluded to this, touched on it briefly in my last couple of slides about the choreography of daily activities. Are there some vital signs that can be clinically validated that are behavioral rather than genomic or biological, and that would actually be very interesting research.
I mean, this isn't exactly what you asked, but I would just implore government to start paying doctors for doing what's right. You know, pay doctors for doing prevention, pay doctors for provisioning care in new and innovative ways, stop paying so much for procedures. I mean, that would have a profound impact on the way healthcare is delivered in this country.
Well, this is sort of a self-interested answer, so I hesitate. But, you know, I am looking hard at how could we work to keep people healthier? And particularly, how can we do that in a way that leverages the talent of the health community?
And I think if government gave seed grants to promising ideas, that would be very highly leveraged, where you'd start to see decreases in diabetes or decreases in renal failure from diabetes or decreases in coronary disease due to that in the way that they did for Andreessen. That's interesting, but I wouldn't overdo it. I mean, frankly, there's more money sitting out there in venture capital pools than they know what to do with. At this point, it's stupid money. And the problem for most people with good ideas is not raising money. The big problem is regulation. I understand that's not in your purview, but you know, when we in the industry think about how we're going to be creative, our big fear is more law, not less law. Our big fear is law. Our big problem today is HIPAA. I mean, one of the reasons doctors don't do mail is because HIPAA told them they couldn't do mail with their patients, and patients use mail. They can't chat with their patients, and patients use chat. You know, and that is a perceived or real limitation of HIPAA. So we look at those laws. We look at laws in some states where you can't electronically deliver the HIV patient's data to the patient, even if you want to, under the grounds of protecting the patient from each other, which means that they can't have early warning systems to tell them when they're in trouble. So honestly, most of what we're looking for is less, you know, is free up the information to the patient rather than fund innovation. I think funding innovation is great, but there's a ton of talent out there and there's a ton of money out there. And the thing that stops a lot of the talent and money right now is the regulation itself. You know, why is it that I can't walk up to a lab and order tests on my lipid, get a lipid assay and keep an eye on it every 6 months? Regulation. You know, and I know this is hard for the government to stop, but this is really what's hurting our productivity and our competitiveness, you know, more than any big hard science thing. That even learning from the genome and from expression, there's a ton of money going into that right now, you know, coming out outside of the government money. The challenge, again, is regulation. And, you know, we live in daily fear that this will get worse, that they'll soon say you can't transfer your genomic information around. And they say that. The one other thing government could do, and they're doing it, I hope, is the thing saying you can't discriminate against people on the basis of their genome. Now, that's clearly a good thing. But last time I looked, that, I hope, is still on track.
Hi, I'm Gary Krebs. I'm at George Mason University. And I'm concerned about issues of access and interpretation and utilization of health information, particularly by diverse and at-risk populations. And so I think one of the big challenges is how do we humanize health information? How do we make it truly understandable to different people? How do we provide them with the kinds of support they need so they can get the specific information they need out of the huge morass of information that's available, and how do we help them actually implement that in their lives in meaningful ways? What kinds of feedback systems can we build into these systems? So I'd like to kind of raise that issue for you guys. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a real challenging question, because if you're aiming at a fourth grade or sixth grade reading level, there are certain concepts that I think are very hard to explain. It takes a lot of work to explain some of these things at that level. I think also if you're talking about English as a second language, you mentioned other diverse populations, different health belief systems and so forth. It's really a challenge to, this is a different kind of translation than what we were talking about earlier, to translate sort of the biomedical information that's coming out of places like NCI and NIH into language that patients from all kinds of backgrounds will be able to understand.
I think... there's sort of two things that are probably useful as analogies. One of them, I just went to Beijing, and as I went through what I'm sure used to be a very intimidating immigration process, which was now totally trivial, I was through the door, out of the plane, through the door, and in a car heading to the hotel much faster than I got in this building today.
Because the threat level there is in yellow.
And as I went through the middle of this, you know, some official looked at my passport, and there in front of me was this strange little three-button device. There was a happy face, an unhappy face, and I think a double happy face or something. And it dawned on me that I was supposed to push whichever of these I felt like about the performance of this individual. And, you know, never have I seen user opinion better turned into a sort of physical device and a way to think about it. And, you know, part of what happens as soon as, you know, is just changing the thinking process. to one like that all by itself would be enormous. And that's why I talked about getting out of hospital data. I'd love to see doctor data as well. Everything that the doctors tend to not want to get out, I'd like to see get out. because, you know, for example, the AMA will give you information about whether someone has had a malpractice event, but not what it was. You know, and it's very hard to get at that data. And that data is useful. And so all by itself, I think that's... The other analogy, though, is Southwest Airlines. It goes back to this issue you bring up about different groups. I flew down to San Diego 2 days ago and then flew back up to San Francisco, and I changed my flight a few times, and I interviewed book, and I used Southwest. Southwest Online is essentially set up at a fourth-grade reading level. You know, even when I'm tired and bleary and it's 3 in the morning, I can sit there and switch my flight because there's a big button that says change your flight. I pick on it and it shows you. I mean, you know, it is set up for a fourth grader. And I think there's a big reason that Southwest is the best airline, the most profitable airline, the fastest growing airline in this country, because they figured out how to make it easy. If you open up a system to people competitively, you know, someone's going to figure out how to do this because that's going to be their niche. And they're going to go out and they're going to compete on the basis of convenience. They'll compete on the basis of talking Spanish as well as English, or even Chinese as well. I live in San Francisco, where it's sort of an equal mix. And I'm not as worried about that, I guess, because I think of Southwest as how things work. As soon as you set up a competitive model, someone will figure out how to get out there and make this stuff at a fourth grade level. Because if they don't, they're going to lose to somebody else who does.
Yeah, in fact, I would add, actually, the airlines have done us a huge favor because they've basically trained everybody in America how to interact with a kiosk. And one of the largest growth areas in healthcare, quite frankly, is going to be kiosks in healthcare for gathering information, intake information, information as you go out of the clinic and swipe your card. And I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And I'm seeing, again, progressive healthcare organizations making use of this technology. The other thing I want to mention is that sometimes solutions... we talk about all this IT, but sometimes it's the simplest things, and sometimes it's things, actually, ideas that come forward by healthcare workers themselves. I'll never forget the story when I was visiting in Ireland, and we were in a public hospital, and they were talking about the care they were providing for a very large socioeconomically deprived group at that time, and the horrendous problems. And, of course, in Ireland, because it's a national system, there's lots of queuing, right? You get an appointment, and then you wait a long time for that appointment. And so what was happening, of course, was these people would get their appointment with the specialist, but it'd be 3 or 4 months down the line, and by the time 3 or 4 months rolled around, they'd forgotten their appointment. They didn't show up. So the no-show rate was like 90% in this clinic. But one of the nurses happened to notice that even the most downtrodden of their population, what did they have? They all had cell phones. So what did they do? They started to gather them information. They started to, 24 hours prior to the appointment, send them a text message. And you know what? No-show rate dropped, I mean, precipitously to the fact that, I mean, it was 95% of the people were showing for their appointment. Sometimes it's the little things.
I'd love to actually turn it around a little bit. I mean, those of you on the right side of the panel now have done a lot of research in patient education and tailoring messages, how patients interact to health threats and so forth. I'd love to hear if you think there's some underserved or under-researched areas that we in industry should be taking a look at.
Yeah, I think one I would put before and get your thoughts on, I'd be interested in is patient demand. So one of the challenges in the prevention and public health domain is how do we create demand for information from people before they're sick? So we talked about the, and talked about the incentives in terms of incentivizing what healthcare providers do, or lowering the cost of insurance by somebody who does not smoke. But we have this wealth of information that could be useful to people, and we also have a lot of tools available now to help people change their behavior or quit smoking, but they're not utilized. So, you know, nicotine replacement therapy for smokers, whatever. So, and in the public health and research domain, we often say, well, the private sector is a source of, you know, how do you market things, these things? So any thoughts you have about how we can better market or create demand for what are already currently available evidence-based strategies that people could use to lower their disease risk?
Well, I mean, there clearly have to be rewards and incentives on both sides of the equation, and I mean, people just have to have skin in the game, and skin in the game can mean lots of different things depending on where one is in life and what one's resources are. But without skin in the game, I mean, what we end up is with the apathetic consumer who just wants everything, and unfortunately, neither government nor private industry can possibly deliver that.
You raise an interesting question, which is how do you market goods and services to people who are part of a group that they don't necessarily want you to know they're a part of? And so that's a conundrum that companies like Procter & Gamble and others have had to face as well. But I also think that there's some interesting examples of innovations in private industry. Humana, for example, has a very interesting incentive infrastructure so that if you go to the health club and swipe your card and get on the treadmill, you can actually get Virgin Miles or Blockbuster video credits or whatever. And I think we raised this before, even microcredits or microdebits on health insurance or other incentives could actually go a long ways.
I think it's a great question. I mean, really, my matrix was wrong. We should talk about the unworried at risk. And, you know, the issue is how do you reach the unworried at risk enough to cause them to get the information they know so they don't go from being at risk to sick. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been thinking hard about that, so that I'm not going to discuss right here, but I do think that one of the key things to think about if I were at the NIH or NCI, one thing that people do tend to do, even when they're unworried, is see a doctor with some routineness. Maybe it's not an annual checkup, but maybe that's what you do. You know, just as there was a seatbelt campaign, you have an annual checkup campaign. And then you leverage the doctor to deploy them into systems that can keep an eye on them. Now, today the doctors can't do that. They don't have systems to keep an eye on them, apart from having them come in a lot more frequently. But if there were such systems, then the medical community becomes a great vector for delivering those systems to patients. So the combination of having such systems, working with doctors to have them deliver, you know, the ones of their choice to their patients, coupled with, you know, an awareness campaign that you should at least see a doctor once a year and figure out are you being monitored properly would be a great step in the right direction. You know, getting people into a mindset where they keep, there's some tool that's keeping an eye on them, which they're just not in today.
More comments? Any questions from the audience?
Right on schedule.
Last question. Suffering a little bit of cognitive dissonance here. On the one hand, one end of the panel is saying, let the market go, we'll solve the problem. And I'm thinking, wasn't the market there all along? And then on the other end of the panel, we hear that we're 15 years behind in what's going on in IT around the world. So my question is, what have they done in other places that are, and what incentives are in place to put them ahead 15 years of what where we are?
Well, I mean, I really draw it down to two factors. Number one, remember that around most of the rest of the world, healthcare is in the government domain. And wisely, around the world, governments have invested far more heavily in IT, and it's going on right now. I reference Canada and the UK, and it's going on elsewhere, too. I mean, in the Netherlands, physicians receive, last I heard, was about a $3,000 a year stipend from the government to invest just in IT, which is why there's 100% electronic medical records there. So that's one reason. The second reason, interestingly enough, if you travel even to some lesser developed countries, you see more use of IT in healthcare, and the reason is it's much like the cellular phone analogy. You know, maybe we were... we're paying a penalty for being early adopters in America. We have a lot of old iron legacy stuff that doesn't work very well that we started using 30 and 40 years ago and so forth. So the cellular analogy is, you know, when you travel overseas to Asia and some of these countries, you see cell phones that are two and three generations ahead of ours, and you see infrastructure, which is amazing. But they didn't inherit the burden of all those wires and all that stuff. They just kind of leapfrogged ahead because technology advanced, commodity pricing came into purview, and so they were able to go wireless all over a country and have these amazing, you know, high-speed phones that do real-time. You can do a video consult with your doctor over your cell phone. So those two reasons, I think, lack of government investment compared to other countries and perhaps the burden of old legacy here in America that we now must overcome. Yeah.
Well, I don't think you heard us say that there was no role for government. I mean, if you look at why those countries do better, and it's not, they're not all doing better. But you know, one big reason is that when you have a system where people are guaranteed health care, suddenly focusing on wellness and prevention, as with Kaiser, as with Group Health, as with UPMC, becomes a priority. And then things naturally happen to encourage that. We don't have that system. You know, and if there's one thing that, you know, you could fault this country for, is that we don't have this idea that the system is designed to guarantee that people have coverage for life. And that is a big issue, because it means we don't focus on wellness. And it's clearly, I think, hurt us a great deal. You know, we've built a system around pain for events and for sickness, rather than focusing on wellness. The second thing you heard me say is that we don't have a system where people have a right to their information. Even in Europe, if you talk to a lot of people, many people are responsible for their own health data. It's electronic, but people are expected to keep track of it, know about their health data, and manage it. In India, people are the exclusive source of their health data. When you go into a doctor's office, typically they give you back the data, and you're expected to take it and manage it and stay in charge of it. We have essentially allowed various interested groups and monopolies to prevent us from doing that. We've allowed regulation to tie up that data when that data should be open. So we haven't said there's no role for government. You know, we think there are two very interesting roles for government at a bare minimum. One, give people right to the data and set some minimum standards for interoperability of that data. And two, you know, and this one's hard because I understand this is nothing that NHNCI can do, but figure out how to change the system so that there actually is an understanding that lifetime wellness is what matters, as opposed to dealing with you when you're sick. And it's not clear how the current system can line up that way, except for exceptions like Kaiser, UPMC, Group Health, et cetera. And you know, I think as was said earlier in response to a question, it's no coincidence that if you compare those systems to Europe, they compare reasonably well. Yeah. If you compare any of the other systems we have, they compare reasonably badly.
Thank you all for your comments and for your thoughts. We're looking forward to talking a bit more afterwards, and then we'll turn it back over to Lindsay.
I'll be brief because I know we've had a long morning, but I just couldn't help thinking back when I was trying to enthusiastically explain to my mom the importance of informatics and IT on changing healthcare and the importance of facilitating collaboration between IT and publicly funded research. She kind of glazed over me and said, you know, informatics. As a two-time cancer survivor, she herself was looking at how can I improve the quality of care? How can I not get lost in this chasm or dropped into the cold ocean after I've been sick? And I think that these presenters, not to my surprise, have done a far better job than I did of explaining today how IT can effectively inform research and how IT can effectively inform the design and direction and hopefully ongoing evaluation of these evolving health IT solutions. So we hope this event and the discussions therein provide a springboard for you all, both to foster and encourage old and new collaborative efforts that will hopefully support cross-disciplinary and cross-sector research and help to translate this research into effective, consumer-centered, scalable health IT solutions. So thank you to the presenters today for their insights and their time, and thank all of you for coming, and we look forward to having those sessions.
I'm never sure.